a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Well, you're going to call this meeting to order and get started. I'd like to greet the internet listeners. Before we get started, I'd like to observe about 1 second of silence for those who lost their lives 70 years ago at Pearl Harbor. Thank you. Moving right on. Just a little reminder to shut the cell phones off. And, excuse me, we'll let the secretary call the roll.
Senator Haverly.
Here.
Senator Hunhoff. Senator Hunstad. Senator Peters.
Here.
Senator Tiedemann.
Here.
Representative Carson.
Here.
Representative Dennert. Representative Dryden.
Here.
Representative Junkie.
Here.
Representative Turbeville.
Here.
You have a quorum.
Thank you, Madam Secretary. I'd ask for approval of the minutes that were mailed out. We had a motion and a second. All in favor, aye. Are there any on today's agenda, are there any changes that need to be made, any additions or corrections to the agenda for today? Hearing none, we will move forward with that. Just a reminder for those who are testifying today that please sign in so the secretary has the correct spelling of your name for the minutes. With that being said, we'll get started right away on the with the Department of Safety. It's going to give us a little bit of an overview in reference to the special disaster fund, and I believe that's Secretary Trevor Jones. Thank you.
Green light is now on. Thank you. Thank you. Good to be with you this morning. I guess if you like, I can go with an overview of each fund that you have listed on the agenda that you sent out via email, or I can start out and you guys could point me in the direction you'd like me to start, and I'll go from there.
Why don't you go ahead with the overview like we sent it out, sir?
Okay. First, according to the document that I have, the Special Emergency Disaster and Revenue Fund. As you guys are well aware, that's the fund that allows for us to meet special emergency requirements through the Division of Emergency Management, which is in the Department of Public Safety. That allows us to work with local communities to meet their needs as the emergency should arise in their specific locale, whether it be, of course, this year the biggest event we had was, of course, the Missouri River flood, which entailed any community, primarily Pier 4, Pier, and Dakota Dunes along the Missouri River, Yankton, of course, included in there as well. Right now is that, along with also, too, the Northeast flooding, which we deal with every year, that also fund allows us to meet those expenditures to help with the protection of public infrastructure in all those areas, which is our main focus in each disaster, so to speak. Right now, the disaster fund fund cash balance sits at $16,536,000. Included in that $16 million is the two loan balances that we have with the communities of Fort Pier and Dakota Dunes. The maximum amount committed in those loans with those two communities were $5 million with Fort Pier and $15 million with Dakota Dunes. Those loans are secured with borrow bonds and issued by the city. The borrower submits a detailed disbursement request for eligible disaster costs, supported by copies of like invoices, payroll records, equipment records. And then from there, we send them off to FEMA to determine if they're eligible for reimbursement according to their rules and regulations and guidelines. From there, obviously, FEMA looks over the project worksheet to determine if it's an eligible cost. If so, they provide reimbursement to the state, and the bills obviously previously been paid. So we put that amount of money towards the loan of these two communities that have already been provided. The term of the loan is 5 years, and the interest shall be accrued at the rate of 4.5%. Any past due payments shall bear an interest rate of 8%. The state's share, right now the estimated cost of the flood to be about $80 million. The state's share will be about $10 million. Obviously, like, subjects change, so that, but it's going to be pretty close. Part of that $10 million that is the state's share, of course, will be the 10% that FEMA doesn't reimburse regarding the locals' expenses. And also included is there the 25% that the state bears as a cost regarding any state-related costs, not local costs. And then also in that $10 million will be ineligible pieces of expenses that aren't eligible through FEMA. So you got your 10%, your 25%, and then just costs that FEMA says that, hey, those costs aren't eligible under the guidelines. You're responsible for them. I think that's what I have primarily on the Emergency Disaster Fund. I throw that out for any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you give us an idea? Are you worried about any of the cities defaulting on the loan? And if there is a default on the loan, what's Plan B?
According to the document, the default in place in the documents is where the communities have in place ways they can raise money to pay the state back regarding the loan balance. And right now, we're not in fear of that. Right now, Fort Pierre, in regarding a lot of the reimbursements that come in through FEMA, they put against the current loan balance. Right now, they're being paid back, and the bigger chunks of the loans that are actually the bigger expenses that were used, that the loan was used to help pay, have been reimbursed by FEMA. So we're seeing a lot of the money being paid back and the loan decreasing, loan amount decreasing.
Giving us an example on the Fort Pierre one, there were the smaller, I believe the smaller of the two loans. On the Fort Pierre loan, how much did they total take out, and then what's their current balance?
They currently borrowed $3,684,000,
okay.
But repaid is $2,466,000, so their balance is $1.2 million, roughly.
If I could follow up. So their original, they were approved to borrow up to what, $5 million or something? Or
that's correct, Senator.
Or something? Okay. All right. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Go ahead, Representative Dennard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just kind of a clarification and then maybe a question, if I would, Mr. Chair. You talked about the interest at 4.5, but it's interest-free, is it not, for the first 18 months, I believe? Is that clarification?
You're correct, sir.
Okay, thank you. Then a question, if I'm Mr. Chair. You talk about the state share, and there's been a lot in the news recently about game fishing parks and our recreation areas and the damages to them. Does that fit in the scope of yours, or is that a separate account that's through game fishing parks? Does that loss or whatever?
The number I gave you, I know with the $16 million, does not include the FUD clause that were denied by FEMA. So whether Game Fish and Parks will present an additional dollar figure to us at some point, I believe they will. But in the current $16 million, it doesn't.
Okay. As I remember, I thought they said something about $9 million of damages up and down there.
And I know we've worked with Game Fish and Parks to determine what damages are around that northeast corner area, and then, of course, anything along the Missouri River to determine what flood costs we could help them with. But I don't know if that dollar figure has been exact amount or not.
So we could anticipate either during session or GF&P coming in with that information.
Or just eventually added to the disaster fund.
Okay. Thank you.
Sir, you talked about 25% state cost on in reference to the flood damage. Traditionally before that, did we not go 15 by the state and 10 for the local entities?
Well, that's when the local costs, when the locals bear the burden of the, if it's a local effort as a local expense, is the best way to put it. The state will pay 10% of that, and then the locals pay 15% of that, and then of course FEMA comes along and pays the other 75%. Now, regarding the 25%, if that's, get to your question. The 25%, there's no locals involved. That's just a state expense that was submitted to FEMA, and then we pay that 25%.
Thank you. With that being said, we're down about $14 million. Is that somewhat close to the number?
Our cash balance says as of 12/2/2011 of 16.5.
We're down about 12
million. Oh, okay, yes, sir.
Do you anticipate any more FEMA picking up any more of that $12 million?
I would say yes, because there are still some, I know, project worksheets that are out there that we're working closely with FEMA, so I would like to think that many of the expenses in there would be eligible, but you never know until they decide. But we're working closely with them to get those eligible expenses put forth and eventually paid for.
Thank you. Any other questions, concerns? Thank you. Go ahead.
I guess according to the document, I'll move on to the 911 coordination fund, if that's appropriate. Yeah, the 911 coordination fund, as you're well aware of, allows for the collection of prepaid wireless and communication services, a fee there. And we use those monies collected from the prepaid wireless telecommunication service to provide disbursements to your local 911s if there are non-recurring costs, and also for the cost of the 911 coordination committee, which was also established at the same time. Some things that we're obviously going to use for that regarding the 911 coordination board itself is the cost of the board, and also travel expenses, those sorts of things. And the primary purpose for the 911 coordination board is to coordinate with all the 911 public safety entry points to make sure that we're operating in a uniform fashion throughout the state. Right now, the fund, the 911 coordination fund, sits at $501,610.31. As of this point, many of our discussions surrounding the 911 coordination fund revolve around assisting those public safety answering points with those non-recurring costs. As you guys are well aware of, the surcharge, the 911 surcharge that's collected, they use those for recurring costs at their specific public safety answering point. We're just regarding the non-recurring costs and how they're eligible. If they're an eligible 911 PSAP, they request through a grant application funds out of the coordination fund to see if we can help them with those non-recurring costs. Right, as again I said, right now the fund's roughly at $501,000. Or no, I take that back. Excuse me. As of 12/2/2011, it's $538,000.
Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. According to the statute, it says any funds collected from prepaid wireless telecommunication services, that doesn't include all prepaid cellular calls. Is that correct, or services?
That's correct. That's only on your the best way to describe it is it would be the ones that you sign a contract for at your Verizon store. It doesn't count your track phones that you might purchase at your Walmart or your Target. Those aren't included in there.
Mr. Chair, if I could follow up.
Go ahead.
So even Verizon, Altel, AT&T, they also have their prepaid phone cards at Walmart, Walgreens. That doesn't include them as well, correct?
That is correct.
Okay. Any other questions, concerns?
I have another question.
Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you. Can you kind of go through a plan that's going? I noticed there's an upward trend, and obviously we know why there's an upward trend in this fund. It's because the prepaid phone cards are becoming more and more common. Is there a plan that's coming forward that's going to deal with the increasing fund, or is there a strategy on what we're going to do with the additional dollars that keep funneling into this?
One of the discussions that's been on the board's mind since the beginning, and I wasn't there from the beginning, but based on some briefings I've had, is the next-gen 911 piece that could be utilized and help defray the cost from some of those public safety answering points that are out there currently. It also obviously bring in better technology for us to provide a better service to the 911 community, which is basically all your citizens of South Dakota. So we'd like to look into costs of the next gen 911 piece that will bring that technology to South Dakota. We know that's fairly expensive. That's why I think, pending on discussions that'll take place in the next upcoming session and what's decided there, the future of 911 really is next gen. So if we decide to go that route and utilize technology, I think a little bit better, that fund, that the $501,000, could be depleted quickly, and we probably would need additional funds down the road, but it could be easily paid for as ongoing costs come into the state regarding that next gen piece.
Go ahead.
Do you know have you done any preliminary research on what it's going to cost for us to get into a system like next gen? Any ideas?
I looked into one system that other states have, and the primary initial investment was somewhere in around $1 million, and then a $1.4 million recurring cost from here on out. And obviously, they can vary from vendor to vendor, and currently, obviously, different demographics in this state to the state that I looked at. So it could be cheaper or it could be more expensive, but it's a ballpark right in there.
You said it was $1.4 million reoccurrence. Thank you. Any other questions, concerns? Thank you. Go ahead and continue.
The next one is the Cigarette Fire Safety Standard Fund Act, which is a fund that was established a few years back, which allows for when new cigarettes are placed on the market through this bill, it requires those new cigarettes to be fire safe. And that's a brand of cigarette that allows for the cigarette to burn at certain speeds, so it will not cause the, like for instance, if you drop the cigarette, it burns less hot, you know. Excuse me. So what allows with the Cigarette Fire Safety Fund is when the new cigarettes should come online, or those older cigarettes when they were out there, when this is established, they pay a certain fee, and a stamp is placed on the pack of cigarettes, so we know that it is a fire-safe cigarette. I could read you the definitions. Reduced ignition propensity cigarette. It has significant less propensity to ignite upholstered furniture, mattress when dropped, forgotten, or carelessly discarded. This can be accomplished through small design change in the cigarette, also less dense tobacco, less porous paper, smaller diameter, filter tip, and the addition of speed bumps. Again, allows for the cigarette, I think, what they claim to burn safer. As you know, that many people every year, 900 to 1,000 people die each year from fires that are started by cigarettes. So what it's designed to do is make the cigarettes safer. They want as these cigarettes come on the market, we collect the fee, and that allows for the cash fund balance that you see maybe before you. The fund balance we have right now regarding the Cigarette Fire Safety Fund is, as of December 2nd, is $135,000. Now, most of your cigarettes obviously have paid this fee. That's why your fund is up there. Each year, you don't have a lot of cigarettes coming online, but if they did come online, they would put the fee would go towards the fund. And that's the background, I guess, regarding the Cigarette Fire Safety Act Fund. Right now, we have presented a bill to LRC that would allow for us to utilize the fund dollars a little bit more. Right now, the only way we can actually basically deplete the fund is if the fire marshals or Department of Revenue actually go out and inspects the local convenience stores to make sure they're selling packs that contain the cigarette fire safe stamp. And so when obviously we do those inspections, we code our time or their time to the fund, but we don't do that all that often. Thankfully, many of the stores are in compliance, so the fund will continue to grow. So we're looking for other ways we can maybe utilize the funds better. You know, one of the things we're looking into is utilize the funding that's there now through this potential bill through LRC is to fund additional training classes for firefighters and fire responders, and also enhance and promote fire safety programs throughout public education in South Dakota. But that's just more or less a FYI for you folks that we are looking at ways to utilize, I think, the fund how it was intended, but unfortunately right now, based on statute, we're somewhat limited.
forward. Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just looking, obviously we're in our first year still, and we've got money. It says license permits and fees at $150,000. Seems kind of a nice round number. Is it just a coincidence that it's such a nice round number?
Okay. I see where you're pointing at there. On the
it actually is.
Just looks like a nice appropriation number instead of a revenues and fees coming in. That's why I asked. Okay. Very cool.
And we only collect every 3 years, so or we collect every year, but again, those new cigarettes don't come online very often. So this year, but in 3 years, all the cigarettes that are currently on the market, they obviously pay the fee again, and so that number might go down a little bit, but then it's going to go back up in 3 years when the current cigarettes are out there, pay the fee again.
Okay, so it's a three-year cyclical thing. So okay, great.
With the new, we're seeing more and more of the roll-your-own cigarettes. Are they required to have the same safety device in the paper?
I'd have to defer to Paul on that, sir, if that's okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul Merriman with the Public Safety Office of the State Fire Marshal. That's an interesting question. It's actually up in the air yet, whether or not, you know, the folks who purchase the equipment for the roll-your-own process, actually, it's being looked at. I believe they provide the equipment, but you roll your own, so the question becomes, you know, are you a manufacturer just because you provide the equipment, or, you know, when you're the person who's the individual who's actually making your own cigarette, do you become the manufacturer? And I think that question's a bit beyond our capabilities. It's more, I think, a legal or maybe an attorney general's type question to look at. So I really can't give you an answer to that today.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Go ahead, Senator.
Well, I thank you, sir. I'd like to follow that up by saying that I would really want you to get us this kind of information. If it's a legal question, that's what we do, is we try to write laws to make this happen. So if you will, I don't know how, Mr. Chairman, you come up with that question, but it's an excellent question, and it clearly is something that we ought to be concerned about. So I would like you to get back with us if you can, if you want to go to the Attorney General, whatever it takes. Keep us in the game. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Any other questions or concerns? Thank you. Moving right along.
The last one on the list is the Motorcycle Safety Fund, which is a fund that requires a fee of $7 to be collected for each motorcycle registered in the state of South Dakota, and then eventually have it deposited in the fund. The fund is solely used for the purpose of motorcycle safety courses and motorcycle safety education. Right now, the balance of that fund sits at $884,000 as of December 12, 2011. Many of there's motorcycle safety courses that are put on throughout the state, and your motorcycle enthusiast rider, licensed rider, pay a fee to attend the course at a specific location, more likely near their home, and the instructor and could be multiple instructors depending on how large the class is, will bring motorcycles to the designated area, which has certain specifications to that area. They'll train the motorcycle riders for 2 to 3 days, depending on the class. The basic class is 2.5 days, and then we have also, along with the basic class that's put on each as often as we can, depending on the amount of attendance or enrollees, we also have a advanced rider course that we put on as well. The expenses of those classes put on throughout the state for those motorcycle riders are the expenses that are going to come out of this fund that you see here that you have before you.
Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Secretary, these are the funds that also pay for the bikes. Is that correct on the motorcycle?
That's correct.
I didn't know if you had mentioned that. And just a comment, maybe. I took this motorcycle course when I started riding, and it's a pretty intensive course. And I think it teaches motorcyclers across the state some valuable safety tips. And I tell you what, every class that I had tracked for about 2 years was full. And so it's motorcyclists paying essentially for the course itself to provide safety. I don't think you'll find a motorcycle group in the state that doesn't support this strongly, just due to the lack of abilities of motorcycle riders out there. It's a really fine course for people that have a concern for motorcycle safety.
Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the comments about the fun, but we've got a trend here that's an uptick, and what's the plan for the money? I don't know if you know that, but I know the BAIT folks probably have a plan.
We work closely with the BAIT and with the South Dakota Safety Council. They are the contractual group that puts on the courses throughout the state, and we have worked with them, a BAIT, and other organizations to establish a five-year plan where we want to obviously increase the amount of riders that attend the course, and we want to not only get the new rider, we don't get that advanced rider at well, because believe it or not, statistically, in fatalities in South Dakota, the rider that dies in the fatality, he's 45 to 54 years of age. So he's not the young kid on the Japanese bike. It's the rider that might think he's advanced or he's a good rider, but maybe he needs that advanced course to help him get rid of some bad habits. So we really have I would call it an aggressive campaign to get more riders to the course and also produce documents and work with we also established a website too called SouthDakotaRides.com where we'll get that information out there. So more the motorcycle enthusiast that is a good rider but wants to be a better rider, they'll know where to go, they'll know where to sign up for the class, and we'll have safer riders out there for South Dakota.
Sir, with this account, do they not purchase motorcycles to be taken from place to place?
There's a cache of motorcycles at certain locations throughout the state, and so they use that cache of motorcycles wherever that. And the thing about the motorcycles, they also need to be replenished too, because they have a life too. So we have to, just because you buy the motorcycle once doesn't mean they're good for forever.
Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you made my point. We ran into this once before, this question before, and as the fund built up, they needed to replace motorcycles. And, of course, motorcycles aren't cheap, but I know they had an array of bikes. Even when I took the course, there was 15, 16 different types of motorcycles, all the way from dirt bikes to street bikes. Different types, Hondas, you know, and they're all low end, but you still have to pay money to refurbish those or buy different bikes. And I think that was a pretty large cost the last time they went through, and the fund went back down, if I remember correctly.
That's correct.
Representative Dennert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Haverly talked about taking this course, and as a senior citizen, I took the course too. So, and I'm not regretting it. And the only thing that you talk about, the $7 that's added, you know, to the fees, when I took the course, there was also a cost to me. There was a registration fee too. Is that money go into here? Is it just the $7, or does the fee that I paid when I signed up, is that pooled through here too?
That is through, but most of that $75, I believe 50 of that, just 50 or 55, just covers the insurance of the rider while they're taking the course.
And I probably knew that, but thanks for the confirmation. Taking the course in Aberdeen, I think, and I'm not a real enthusiast, I just took it for another reason, and did pass, by the way, but it wasn't easy for me. The writ was no problem, the writing, as I never rode. But it seemed to me, is 150 sound like the right size of a bike? I think at Aberdeen they were all 150s.
I believe they're all 250cc.
Okay, maybe they were two. Well, that's immaterial. The only complaint I would have as a senior citizen taking the course, and maybe you could pass it on, my intent was to get the permit, and that was the only way I could get it. But I ride a four-wheeler in the farm every day, but that's a little different deal. I shouldn't say every day, but my intent was to get the permit to ride the new trike, the three-wheel trike, and you see more and more senior citizens or senior people riding a trike. And I passed, and I did it successfully for 2 years out at Sturgis. Thank the Lord. But my thought was is the training on the 250 or the 150 is altogether different than what I planned on riding. Would there be an opportunity to train? I mean, the three-wheeler training would be so much different because of your figure eights and stuff. Well, I'm not going to do a figure eight on a two-wheeler, but you can't do – yeah, you do a figure eight on a three-wheeler, but it takes a lot of room to do it. It's more the safety and the reflex, I think, that I, you know what I mean, the safety, the stop, the start, the signals, what you're supposed to do, and I think I'm versed in that. But I was just thinking, should that not be something that we should look at for the advance or to refresh me that a three-wheeler be available to go in and see if I'm capable of responding, you know, to continue that license? Because once I have it, I don't lose it unless some infraction. So it's more information or something maybe you should look into, because I would, if I had to guess riding Sturgis with the three-wheeler, I'm going to say one out of every 40, 50 bikes is a three-wheeler now of some sort. And I'm just guessing. Don't take that. And so you're going to see more people ride bikes longer in the case of my age. And it was interesting what you said about the 45, 50-year-old person that's having the most accidents. Doesn't surprise me either because of the situation and the bikes. But it's just more of a comment on the issue, and I was curious about the fee that I paid in. And thanks for refreshing me. I guess I knew there was insurance coverage for me at that time.
Representative Junkie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Secretary, I think Senator Peters brought up a legitimate trend there as the fee was reinstated recently. And when you meet with them, say, can you relay to them that there is a concern of this escalating balance that seems to be growing because it's prime for the picking with the economic times we have of late, and I'm sure they have a plan. It's self-imposed upon themselves. So, but just relay that from this committee to them when you meet with them that there is a growing concern of the escalating balances in their account.
Will do. Yes, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do we have any other questions or concerns for the Secretary? If not, thank you very much for being here this morning and being part of it. Thank you for the information. It's very helpful.
Thank you.
I do not see Commissioner Zenter in the audience. Why don't we move forward, unless somebody has a big objection, to Representative Dryden.
Way to go, trouble.
let's move our 2 o'clock up. Are you prepared for that, sir?
Yeah, thank you. Pressure's on, huh? Thank you. On November 9th, Representative Carson and myself with Tim Flannery from Legislative Audits met with Deb Mortensen, AGC, Jerry Johnson, a contractor, and Jason Gusso, an insurance provider, to talk about some of the issues with the Office of State Engineer and general contractors. And we had a list of about 6 or 7 items that we covered. The first item, and I think when we get done, we could just email this list out to everyone. To establish a time limit to approve construction change orders, the process for time extension. State engineer agreed to require architects and engineers to process written change orders on a monthly basis. State engineer will draft language to include the general conditions for Attorney General's office to review. What happens sometimes, I think, with change orders is they're small items. So a contractor or an architect will accumulate several small items to put on one change order. And so you get a small item or 2 or 3, a contractor goes ahead and does the work. But the change order isn't processed, and so it gets tangled up. They can't put in for payment because the change order hasn't been approved, and so they just decided we'd process change orders once a month like they do payments. Then you don't get that timing issue about when the work's done and when you can get paid. So I think that's a good resolution. The second item was establish time limits to sign off on punch list. General contractors were concerned that punch list items are being found and documented after the original punch list is developed at the substantial completion, and final inspections are not being conducted in a timely manner. Office engineer agreed to write some language to include general conditions, putting a time limit for punch list items of 30 days. Sometimes the punch list items get very, very lengthy on a project, and then it becomes, should have this building, should there have been a substantial completion certificate issued for that building? Because if you've got hundreds of items on a punch list, then the building wasn't substantially complete in the first place. So, but she's going to draft some conditions to put a time limit of 30 days. A third item, require final payment of balance contract within 30 days after contractor submitted complete. Accurate application for payment, and the comment item 3 should be reconciled once we get item 1 and 2 in place. It should help with that. And then there was 3-4 items under legal, discontinue practice of withholding money when contractor has a payment and performance bond. Payment should be based on value of completed work. Office engineer said there was many reasons outlined in contract and state law why you can withhold money. Christy Honeywell and Justin Gusso agreed that payment and performance bonds are for large items, not for small punch list items. That's not the intent of a bond. So that's just not the way to do it. And we agreed. Discuss subcontractor payments as defined. Office engineer was concerned that general contractors are submitting 100% of subcontractors' work, then retaining a portion of the subcontractors. And that was happening. They were submitting for work that maybe wasn't done, and then the contractor was withholding the payment to the subcontractors, and that, again, is not the process. They should not be submitting for payment for work that's not completed. And the third bullet point there, AGC says it's not a common occurrence, but they will speak to their membership to try to resolve that. Next item, established dispute resolution provision. There's a Department of Transportation has a process where a third-party group meet to resolve the dispute, and Christy's going to look into that and talk to the AG's office to see if we can use that process with other construction projects. And then the last item there, adoption of a family of documents. There was a lot of discussion regarding that. Some language in consensus documents is conflictive of state law. Contractors could modify language in the existing consensus documents that would not be acceptable for the state. And then the very last statement, if state contracts are more rigid than private contracts, it is because the state is required to accept lowest responsible bid. So you do need, the state's taking acceptable risk, so you do need tighter contracts with more language in that. And that pretty much covers it. There's a bottom of the page. There's a few items that we talked about in addition to that, but I think it was a good meeting. I think we had a meeting of the minds with people involved and resolved some of the issues that keep coming to this committee. There's not as many really big issues as sometimes it appears to be, but with that, if there's any questions, I'll try to answer.
I'd just like to say that I thought the meeting went extremely well. I think it was they were very pleased on both sides, everybody that sat down and who was at the table. There was a lot of open lines of communication, maybe hadn't been there before, and it was supposed to be about a two-hour meeting, and I think it went a little over 3.5 hours. So I thought it was very, very well put together. Thank you. Any questions for Representative Dryden? Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Either you or Representative Dryden, in this discussion, and it just as I heard Representative Dryden present this, a thought came to me, is there anything in here that should go through a rule change? Or maybe Tim. I mean, is there any rules out there that deal with this, or would this document or any this document require any rule changes? I guess that's the thought that came to my mind. Maybe the question should have been for you, Tim.
I didn't sense that from the meeting. I think, like Representative Dryden said, they opened up lines of communication. Now, if there becomes a legal question, Christy works pretty closely with the Attorney General on those issues, and I think the AGC seemed satisfied with what was talked about, and it could be worked out kind of more of an operational thing, more so than I sense it was more operational issues than legal issues.
Any other questions or concerns? Thank you, Representative. Well, we're running. I still do not see Commissioner Zenter in the room. Why don't we take a 10-minute break? We'll go ahead and we'll get started again and come out of recess and move forward. I think at this time we're going to ask Bob Christensen to give us a status on the 2011 audits and update.
I'll just give a brief status on where we are as far as the audits. Presently, so we have some separately issued financial statements that we provide opinions on. The Ready Fund, Finance Authority, the Investment Council, which is the audit of the South Dakota Cash Flow Portfolio, Cement Plant Retirement Portfolio, and Schoon Public Lands, Health and Education Enhancement Trust Fund Portfolio, and the Health and Ed Portfolio, and that those are all part of the Investment Council audit, and also an audit of the South Dakota Pre-Existing Condition Insurance Plan. Those have been completed, and they should be out on our website shortly, in that they were clean opinions, meaning we didn't have any problems with the accuracy of the financial statements, and there was no audit findings. There was a prior audit finding on the Ready Fund report regarding the accuracy of the financial statements, and that was resolved this year. So good news is there's no findings on those reports. Additionally, at the present time, we're doing the audits of the lottery and the Cement Plant Retirement Fund, so those should be available for the next meeting that presents the results for those. And yet to be started is Education Enhancement Trust Fund Authority and the Science and Technology Authority, which is a home stake mine authority out there, and that those will be starting in the next month or so. Additionally, in that CPA firms do perform audits of various entities, South Dakota Retirement System, Soybean Council, Corn Council, Unemployment Insurance Fund, operated by the Department of Labor, and the Housing Authority. Those audits are either in progress or have been completed and should be on our site shortly. Some of those do have findings, which we will go over in the upcoming meetings. To let you know where those are sitting. Additionally, in that we are in the process of the state single audit, routing a number of grants again this year. No major findings that we've come up with this year. And we have just started the audit of the state's comprehensive annual financial report, the overall financial statements for the state of South Dakota. So we'll keep you updated on where we're at as far as that, and also any findings that we might have as they would come up.
Are there any questions for Mr. Christensen? Any concerns? Thank you very much. It's very helpful. Yep. Moving right along, we have Commissioner Zenter in the room. We'll go ahead and get started with the borough personnel. Morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Sandy Zinner, Commissioner for the Bureau of Personnel. Happy to be here this morning. Is that better?
Yep.
Okay. Happy to be here this morning. I didn't come with a prepared report, but am prepared to answer questions that members of the committee have about compensation.
At our last meeting, there was some concerns about how the bonus was paid in the H1N1 program and why there was, in the audit finding there was a problem in the audit finding. If you could go through that and kind of explain to us how that might have been prevented and how what happened, we'd appreciate it. I believe that's the gist of why we've asked you to come in this morning.
Okay, Mr. Chairman. From our perspective, I'll try to cover how we were brought into the loop and why we're brought into the loop, and I won't attempt to answer the questions that the Department of Health would be responsible for, but as you I wasn't here and for Secretary Hollingsworth's testimony, but we did work very closely with the Department of Health after they came over with a request for a bonus for the individuals that worked, put in a considerable amount of work on the H1N1 influenza vaccination. We don't get a lot of requests like that. It was a major request for the ability to reward several employees that had put in a significant amount of their time on that project. When we were first broached about the issue, we discussed whether or not it was appropriate, and Secretary Hollingsworth felt that, based on the fact that they had done such a fantastic job and had been recognized nationally, that it would be a great opportunity to be able to recognize in a very small way those employees that had contributed their time and efforts to get the number of adults vaccinated in the state that were vaccinated. So we spent a lot of time working with them, developing some criteria on who should be a recipient. They indicated that the grant would be available to be able to pay for that, and that's not my area of expertise or our area of expertise, but we did go through and establish some criteria. We didn't have a plan for it in advance because the basis of it was because they did receive the highest rating of vaccinations, and they were number one in the country, and were recognized by a couple different sources for that. And so they didn't know that that was going to occur ahead of time, and that was really the basis for why they wanted to move forward and recognize these people.
Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At least in, I guess I, this is going to be a two-pronged question. First of all, do we have a plan in place when it comes to state bonuses? Is there a generic plan or something on how to go about doing this?
Mr. Chairman, no, there isn't, because we don't get a lot of requests, and so we treat any request on an individual case-by-case basis, review the request, make a determination whether it's appropriate, and then in most cases, we end up running it through the governor's office as well. So we don't have a set policy.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. It'll probably be a string of questions. I think part of the issue was the way, at least from an appearance standpoint, that it was backed into. The ability to give a bonus was not, I don't know what to say. It wasn't premeditated. It was backed into, and the amount was backed into. There were several issues. Is there something wrong with a state having a generic plan to be able to pay bonuses? Is it taboo not to do that from a state's perspective? Just to have a generic plan that an agency can say, well, this is how we have to go about doing this?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if it's necessarily bad, but we do have salary policy in place that addresses all the different ways that compensation is provided for in the cases that come up. And again, we don't get a lot of requests for bonuses. I guess it may appear that it was backed into, but there was nothing on the front end, when they started the process, to indicate that they would have had received the top record of vaccinations in the country. And that's what really prompted the request to do it. I mean, if you're recognized and you have a group of employees, and they not only worked, from what I understand, they not only worked on the vaccinations, but they also took all the shipment into the State Department of Health, and then that wasn't required, and then sent those vaccinations out. And so there was better control. I think they felt there was probably a better coverage because of that. So it wasn't something that was pre-planned, and I don't know how to answer it other than that. The request came from the department because of the outstanding work that was performed and the national recognition.
I can't find my notes, be it a computer sitting in front of me. I think there was, at least in part, there was a rule that was attached with the H1N1 that basically stated that you could use it for compensation, and I'm looking for some kind of help here, that addressed how you could pay bonuses. And I think that's where the issue came to the forefront, was that there really wasn't anything in place to address that in the state. And so out of, I don't want to say desperation, but I mean, in order to pay the bonuses, then all of a sudden they magically created this system to be able to do it for this particular grant. And again, it's not that I don't think anybody on this committee doesn't disagree with the fact that they had the ability to. It's the process that was in place in order to address the actual grant or that. And I think that's where my line of questioning goes to you, since I think Bureau of Personnel plays a huge role in that ability. I don't, and I'm not, trust me, you have many more years of service in the state than I do, and I'm not going to question, how you do things. But at least in this particular case, it appeared that there wasn't any kind of a plan in place to be able to facilitate using that money for bonuses. And I think that sort of is why the secretary last meeting drew so much fire, because there wasn't. She couldn't give us the answers.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying whether I'm hearing them now or not, but I think we need to take a different look at the process, because, that's what it is. If state government turns into a process, but you can maybe remark on that.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I can understand your frustration with not seeing anything formal in place. Again, I have to go back and say we don't have a formal process in place, because I don't know that there would be a formal process that would meet all of the possibilities that might pop up. I mean, saying that, I also have to say again that we don't get a lot of requests. So it's hard to have I guess our policy would be that if there's a request, we would investigate, determine whether or not it seemed appropriate based on the information that was given to us, and make a determination at that time. I know it's more vague than you're probably looking for, but it is what we do, and I don't know if that answers your question, Senator, or not, but...
Representative Dennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, you know, I'm going to back up and maybe gather a little more information, and Secretary of Health, Deneen, would be here. It would probably be more fitting for her to answer these. So if you can't, please, I'll excuse you. I mean, it isn't that important. But back to you saying this morning that when Secretary Hollinsworth came to you and made the request, because we've got this grant money and the employees did extraordinary work and got a citation for doing, you know, best in the nation or however you stated it. I guess the question, if you can't answer it, please, I forgive you. Did the bonuses only go to the employees in Pierre? I mean, the state employees in the Department of Health? Can you answer that? Do you know?
Mr. Chairman, are you asking, did they just go to the Department of Health employees?
Yes, in Pierre. Well, Pierre, is there a branch in Sioux Falls, Aberdeen, or wherever?
They would have gone to Department of Health employees who worked on it a significant amount of time anywhere in the state.
Okay, anywhere in the state. Okay, I wanted to get that, so then that justifies my thoughts a little further. My concern was, because they got the citation, or whatever you call it, for doing such a good job, you know, it took more than the people in Pierre to get this and the high percentage of vaccinations. I mean, there was volunteers, no doubt, in Eagle Butte and
Correct.
Armour and... you know, all over the state that helped, you know, get the word out, do the work. And so that was why I asked if it only, you know, came to Pierre, because you stated something about, well, they took all the shipments here, which they did, and I appreciate that. And then they dispersed them out of here to all parts of the state. So there had to be other groups of people that really helped with this process and made this really work and get the high percentage, and that's where my concern came. Did the bonus awards only go to the people that worked down over the hill here in Pierre? And you gave me that answer, and thank you. That it justifies it a little bit more for me at this stage and how the bonuses were handled. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, I do have a copy of the letter that Secretary Hollingsworth sent to Senator Hanoff and Representative Tiedemann July of 2010, and that says the bonus went to DOH employees statewide and in many different positions, including, you know, if you think about the community health nurses that are located around the state, so nurses and clerical and shipping room staff, but it was a statewide. Yeah, it wasn't just the DOH employees in Pierre.
If I might, and thank you, and I didn't intentionally try to put you on a spot because that helps clarify it for me, and I probably had a copy of that letter, and knowing me, you know, it probably went over here, and it wasn't 20 minutes ago, so I forgot it, but, you know, that was my concern today because you talked about their award for being doing such a great job statewide, and it all wasn't done out of Pierre, South Dakota. It had to be the branches out, too. Thank you.
Go ahead, Representative Turberville.
All right. Well, I wasn't here for the presentation by Ms. Hollingsworth, but from what I've been able to determine in conversations and reading the minutes and what have you, I guess first of all, you know, I support that. I think any time that we can give a bonus to people, to state employees who have worked above and beyond what is required of them, I don't see a problem with that. You know, and so I would be to the point of encouraging such a thing. I would say that we should congratulate Ms. Hollingsworth and the people that of the Department of Health who did this. However, I support what Senator Havely said, and even though you indicated that, you said you don't have a policy in place, and you came up with a couple of sentences that you indicated were very vague, I would accept that. I mean, I think, and this may never happen again, but if it does, I think it's if you could just sew together a real brief policy statement or whatever that says, in the event bonuses are available, you and the department head will sit down and determine, if you should accept this, and who should get it. So, and like I said, I support giving of the bonuses. I just think that you need to have a policy stash someplace away. Then, in the event it happens again, then you're covered. But I agree with Senator Haverly. That's the only criticism I have is that there wasn't something in writing.
Okay, I appreciate that.
Senator Teterman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, since my name was mentioned in a letter, Secretary Hollingsworth did contact at that time Senator Hunhoff and I as co-chairs of appropriations and did inform us about the possibility of being able to award bonuses because there were dollars that were still available within that grant. I did not follow up on the specific requirement that Mr. Flannery has brought to our attention, and that came out in the audit. I think one reason why there were dollars available was because of all of the volunteer work that was done across the state by the communities, the emergency response teams in each community, because I know when it was done in Brookings that it wasn't done by the Department of Health here. But again, the guiding force, the direction came from the Department of Health and helped put in place how we as a community could respond in delivering it. I think one of the things that we need to look at is that when our agencies put in a request for federal grants, you always include that as a request, that if there's funds available that you can award bonuses or salaries. So that we learn from past mistakes because we don't want to be left out. The reason why other states spent all their money is because they were not as efficient as South Dakota. And so let's reward our efficiency at this point in time. At the time when we were asked, do you support giving the bonuses because of the ranking, because of the record that had been performed in South Dakota, we said it was a neat opportunity to reward the staff that had been involved with it. Again, I did not know the audit situation that was going to come up with, only basing the information on what we were presented at that time. I think there are other departments that do have bonus programs written in, i.e. Department of Transportation, snowplow operators. If they complete the season without an accident, they receive a bonus. It's written in. And it's a savings to the state because if they don't collide with cars and other things and don't wreck the equipment that they're driving, it's a huge savings to the state. And that all came out in appropriations a year ago when that was shared with us in the fall of all of the different bonuses that were given. I believe those who train guard dogs. I love dogs, but I don't know if I want to be attacked by an attack dog. So there are things. As you get older, Senator, you tend to lose some of that sense of adventure. You don't dive quite as quickly or get up as quick. So, but irregardless, I think there are some things in place. But that kind of gives to where the response from the appropriations chairs at that time. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Dennard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, it kind of just begs a question then after the budget address yesterday, and I guess the governor didn't want to use the word bonus, but all of the news media said bonus. And being this is a statewide for all state employees, you said there's not a policy in place. Is this just is there a policy in place for what Governor proposed yesterday? I mean, I know that it's taken so much state money, general fund, so much federal and other, so evidently it just follows a guideline that's already in place. Is that kind of the answer I'm going to get from you?
Well, I think you heard from the governor the guidelines that he had in mind would be that it would be 5% of salary for all employees other than elected officials and permanent. I mean, they would have to be off probationary employees, and so that would be, you know, the policy statement would reflect that. Yes. And I do, if I could, I certainly hear what you're saying, and we don't do a lot of grants within the Bureau of Personnel. Actually, we don't do anywhere. We don't have a lot of federal funds other than we do do some risk pool things. But I certainly would be able to pass that information along, and maybe they do need to write it into the grants. I know there are some where they specifically do. And then if they are able to offer some type of bonus, that availability is there. So I mean, I think if that would alleviate that piece of the audit finding, I'm sure the agencies would be, you know, very receptive to doing that. It's no indication that a bonus would be paid, but would just lay some groundwork if after the fact, for some reason, there was a determination that a bonus should be paid.
Senator Haverly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to be honest with you, you know, when the Secretary is in front of us, I didn't even really know if it would be your agency that would be charged with something like this. I mean, because it was up to them, that agency, to actually write the grant. But having said that, I think the reason your name was brought up is because it is the Bureau of Personnel and it is a personnel issue. And I don't know what the answer is. I just know that for something good like this, we don't want to have to be killing a lot of time at GOAC. We'd rather look at the things that, I mean, everybody on, like I said at my opening statement, I think everybody on the committee agrees with that fact. It's just, I don't know where you go from here. I don't know if you want to get with agency heads and say, look, in the future when you do a grant, let's make sure that we have all the T's crossed and the I's dotted before we, again, mm-hmm. it was a perception that we
sure.
had up here.
I appreciate the comments. And we do not get involved on the front end at all on it. And we wouldn't have been involved in this at all except they came to us after the fact to review the bonus. So I will certainly pass that along and might be able to handle that in the future.
Representative Dennert.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sorry I didn't bring this up when I had the mic, but I just had a comment to add. Senator Haverly brought up the point, like I think, too, and Representative Turberville, the same thing. I kind of agree that maybe some boiler-type policy in place would sure help not create a problem for us to handle down the road if this ever comes up again, you know, because our state has been known and have had other citations for good work done. Not that there's been any bonuses that have went with it. So I agree with their comments and just wanted to make a comment on that from this side that I think something maybe should be in place at least to kind of so we don't go down this road again in the future.
Mr. Chairman, if I might add, it's very possible that it occurs a lot of times in grants and that, you know, already, and I'm not aware of it because we don't get involved on the front end on the grant writing. So some of the agencies might already include that kind of language in it, in the application, and it might already be in the grant as it's awarded as well.
Are there any other questions? Yeah, I guess to sum this up, would you say that I'm somewhat correct in saying that that because of the people of the state of South Dakota operated so efficiently, unknown to them ahead of time that there was going to be money left over, we went ahead and applied the money to where we felt best it was supposed to be?
If I could add, not so much money left over, but the outstanding work that they did to gain national recognition as the top influenza, the state immunizing the greatest percentage of adults, I think is the language that they do. And the fact that there was dollars left over then provided them the ability to use that resource.
Thank you very much for coming in this morning. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
As we move forward, we're running a little bit ahead of time, but I see that Secretary Gerlach's in the audience. Are you ready to go?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
I made a mistake the first time.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thanks again for helping pass those out. I got a handout that goes through funds that we want to talk about today. The first being in video lottery fund 6516, our video lottery operating
it's
fund,
microphone on.
And then our special bred racing fund and special revolving.
I apologize. I will start over.
There you go.
Good to be here, Mr. Chairman, members of the... Yeah. at the last Lottery Commission meeting, I gave my full testimony, and I thought I had the mic on just like I did there, and they didn't realize it until afterwards. But with that, it's still good to be here. And talk about company 6516, our video lottery operating fund. And then our South Dakota Bred Racing Fund and Revolving Racing Fund, Fund 3185. And, Mr. Chairman, I think what I'll do is I'll go through the operating fund and obviously take questions as we go. But I think I'll pause after I get done with the VL, video lottery. And if you guys want to talk about that a little bit, we can. And then delve into the racing funds.
Very good.
Okay. The purpose of the Video Lottery Operating Fund is for the expenses of the Division of Video Lottery, of which we have 9 FTE and $2.4 million in other fund authority. This is established in 427A, which states there is created in the State Treasury the Video Lottery Operating Fund, into which there will be deposited fees opposed in this of 0.5% of net machine income. If you think about it, we get 100% of the net machine income. 50% goes into the property tax reduction fund, or 50% goes to the owners, 49.5% goes to the property tax reduction fund, and then 0.5% goes to fund the Division of Video Lottery in our budget. Revenues are that annual fees from the manufacturers, distributors, and operators, as well as the established license, will pay this 0.5% of net machine income. Within video lottery, the machine manufacturers, distributors, operators, and establishments have fees that they pay on a yearly basis. Each video lottery machine manufacturer, distributor, and operator is licensed by our state Division of Video Lottery and Lottery Executive Director Norm Lingle. The commission, which is the Lottery Commission, also has some oversight in promulgating rules as to how we do the licensing. Each year, a video lottery machine manufacturer pays $5,000. That's their annual fee. A distributor also pays $5,000. Of note, most of the manufacturers are also distributors, so they both pay the $5,000 of both of those fees. Each operator pays each year the greater of $1,000 or $100 per machine as licensed. Currently in South Dakota, we've got about 9,200 video lottery machines in existence that our operators use. This generates us about $1.1 million each year from this fee. Video lottery establishments, of which there are currently about 1,450, also pay a $100 fee each year. And again, as I stated earlier, the distribution of the net machine income is as follows. 50% of the net machine income to the operators or the owners, 49.5% to the property reduction fund, and 0.5% deposited in the video lottery operating fund. And that's been in place since 89 when the state of South Dakota got into video lottery. There's one other collection fee that I'll also throw out there because I know you guys talk to your constituents. There is a manufacturer's fee of $15,000 each year. Now, that goes into the state general fund, but I mention it in that it is an additional fee that we have set up originally. And conceivably, if you're a manufacturer, you could pay $5,000 each year, as I stated earlier, a distributor $5,000 each year, and then you pay an additional manufacturer fee of $15,000. So you could pay up to $25,000 a year in annual fees to do this. In the last year, we've actually gotten, and you'll see this, I think, in the budget going forward, the line games have generated more manufacturers who want to have their machines out there for the operators to play. So we went in the last year from basically two manufacturers that we've had almost from the beginning to eight now. We've had eight manufacturers who want to get in the line game business. So from that perspective, the line game is going to generate more annual fees from manufacturers and hopefully players as well. Some of the expenditures that I'll go through, Mr. Chairman, as I stated, this is the source for funding the video lottery division within our Division of Lottery. Personal services, operating expenses are budgeted here each year. Additionally, some transfers are things that we also spend money on. When lottery was set up, there was put into code a stipulation for the treatment of gambling addiction that's been in there, been in our operation since the beginning. Each year we transfer to, it was the Department of Human Services, but now Social Services, monies for gambling addiction. And what they do is they have a program within their department, and if people have issues or problems, they help them. And then they send us a bill each year for a reimbursable cost of what they spent for addiction and problem gambling for that year. We have $214,000 in our base. In FY11, we did transfer $156,000 to them, and that was the bill that they had for that year. So that's one of the ongoing transfers that we have and ways we use money within the video lottery operating fund. Some of the non-routine expenditures I will go into, and I think a way to look at this is we have a partnership, obviously. The state administers video lottery in South Dakota, always has, but the operators and the manufacturers play a very big role in this. One of the key areas that we do is set up the infrastructure so that if you have a casino anywhere in South Dakota, electronically you have the means to transfer the data from your players to our video lottery central office here in Pierre, and then we can take a look at your numbers and reimburse you accordingly. So the infrastructure is one of the things that is really important that we do. And remember, we're talking about up until the last year or two, an industry and business model that was 20 years old and had not had a lot of upgrades since its inception. In 2010, we did spend $2.9 million for a new video lottery central system that we purchased. It's a computer system that helps us communicate with our operators out there in the field. Along with that effort, we did buy some site controllers. And what the site controllers are, they're the actual machines, so to speak, that you have in each one of your establishments that takes the data from your players and your machines and transfers it to our central system in Pierre. The other thing that we did recently in 2012, and this goes in accordance with the line games, we did purchase 800 multi-drop connectivity devices. And what that is a box that helps us communicate also with the operators to our central office. Many of the operators, when we got into line games, had machines that were 20 years old. Line games are an advanced machine that definitely has some neat and new technology on it. If you had a machine that you purchased in 1990, you couldn't put a line game on it unless you had an MCD or multi-drop connectivity device. What we did to assist them and get the information that we need to account for the sales and the play out there with our operators, we purchased these devices. It's a little box about this big. Hook it into our SAS, which is our site controller out in the each casino, and that allows us to communicate with our central office, and we can tell the play, the numbers, and then reimburse the operators accordingly. So that was one thing that we purchased this year, and I will tell you that the operators out there in the field were appreciative of that because they want to get into line games. Many of these guys have been around for 20 years. They're looking for a new business model and some new things to give to their players. Obviously, the smoking ban has inhibited some of their revenues and ways of doing business. So they are interested in moving forward, and that's the way that we in revenue and lottery can also help them. So again, an MCD is needed for each video lottery establishment with the SAS protocol, and that was one of the other expenses that we had recently that are non-routine as part of the video lottery operating expense. 65-16. So, and just an update. Everybody asks about video lottery, and I think we all want to see where it's going in the future. You know, and right now we're about 18-20% down since the inception of the smoking ban, and those are some, I think, pretty well published figures. I do think that line games are going to be important in how we go forward. The Rules Review Committee of the Legislature allowed us to do that last May, and since then our lottery staff has been working hard to get the new machines in so you can play line games, get them out to the operators, get them set up, and then also try to get the operators enthused about buying some of these new machines to do the line games, because this is really the next step of where we're going in the lottery. And to date, I think as of last week, we had 656 line games currently in operation across South Dakota. I know one of our larger operators bought about 150 last week, so we're looking at about 800 machines, new machines right now that can play the line games. Hopefully that continued to grow. That will continue to grow. And I went to the Music and Vending Association conference last week in Deadwood and had the ability to talk to a lot of our operators. And I think they're ready for the change. I think they're ready to update the model in their industry. And I think that they're bought in for the most part and moving forward. And I know not everybody's that way. And there's some frustrated people out there. But I will guarantee you that revenue and lottery and the governor are doing what we can to enhance the video lottery in the state, because it's a huge part of our budget, and quite frankly, I think it's a fabric we have in South Dakota that I don't see it going anywhere anytime soon. So that's kind of a rundown, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, on video lottery, the fund, and I'd be happy to take any questions if you want to do that now.
Senator Haverly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You covered a lot of my questions in your brief, which is awesome. I didn't have to ask them. How many machines are manufactured in-state versus out-of-state? Is there any companies left? I know there was one out
there. Yeah, there is. Actually, there's one for sure in Watertown and Milbank right now. And if memory serves me right, I think that's the only one right now.
And then where do we get – I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Where do we get the rest of our machines from then?
We have a – there's one manufacturer in Montana. There's one that is actually out of Canada, but they have offices across across the U.S., several in Nevada, I know for sure. Obviously, a lot of our ideas and technology come from there. So those are really the three places that we get the machines from.
And, Ms. Chair, again, I'm going to just do a couple of quickie questions here. Along with that, do we – is there some kind of a how do you say this? Is there a cost benefit as to how many machines somebody produces, or is that video lottery machine manufacturer fee, regardless of how many you produce, it's a $5,000 fee?
So it is. They owe us $5,000. Now, the beauty of that is that if I'm an operator out there and one of our manufacturers wants to sell me a machine, of which they do, you can negotiate the price based on economies of scale. Or, and I kind of like this portion of it now. You know, we went from two manufacturers to eight, so it's a little more competitive. So that $12,000 or $10,000 machine from 2 years ago may be $7,000-$8,000. So I think it's a buyer's market right now for the operators. I think that they get a better machine, pretty neat looking machines. And I think that's to their advantage going forward.
I've heard the line games are. It's pretty awesome. Now, there's an upgrade that they can do without buying a new machine, isn't there?
Yeah, there's one company, and I don't think I'll – I think this is public information. Spilo, which is a great partner of ours, and they've been in it from the beginning. They've got a pretty good machine that is still in pretty good shape, and if you wanted to do an upgrade to your Spilo machine, you had the ability to do that and then get the line games on that as well. And some of our operators have done that. But Spilo's, I talked to the Spilo rep out in Deadwood last week, and he's got a brand new machine that looks real good too. So he's trying to move away from that. But yeah, you're right. You could update your Spilo machine. That's the only one.
Mr. Chair, I have a yes and no, and then one last question. I should know this. Deadwood Games, do they fall into this at all? If they're part of the video lottery system, I'm assuming yes. If they're not, or are Deadwood Games totally separate?
Totally separate.
Okay. And then, as it applies to this particular fund, and you may have said this, you did a great job of briefing us up on this fund, but are we making an effort, particularly with this fund, to help or assist game owners with an upgrade to line games?
Yes, and what we did was, quite candidly, the MCDs, the multi-drop connectivity devices, We bought them for them. And you know what? It was the way that state government said, hey, we're with you on this. Line games are important. We'll buy these for you. And it did tie into the infrastructure part of what we needed. And it was really our way of working with our partners out there. And they were appreciative. I mean, you know, did we have to do it? No. But it made sense that we did it. It made sense that we give them the technology to communicate their numbers to us. So that was kind of our skin in the game on this.
And you mentioned the cost for those. Well,
it was about $500 apiece, of which I think $423,756 is what we spent on them.
And is there any strings attached to it? I mean, if I was a game owner and didn't upgrade, I still need that unit to send the information, correct?
Because you want to get in the line games, you do. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Are there any Representative Dennert?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Gerlach, you kind of answered one question. I think I wasn't paying attention totally. On revenues, subsection 1, you said the manufacturers pay the fee of $5,000, and I just jotted down how many are there, and you said maybe originally 2, but now there's 8?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Could a manufacturer also be a distributor?
Yes.
And
Most are.
Mm-hmm. And how many are them? Is it the same 8 then, or could there be more distributors?
Right now, I think we have 2 distributors and 6 people that are in both.
Okay. That was where my questions. And you probably said it, and I didn't quite gather it, but I know you talked about the number that's increased because of the online or whatever. Thank you.
Are there any other questions or concerns moving forward?
Okay.
Thank you.
We'll talk next about the South Dakota Bred Racing Fund and Special Revolving Fund 3185. The purpose here is both funds are used to support live tracks by either providing funds to all horse tracks licensed in South Dakota or to increase the purses. Neither fund requires an appropriation or disbursement. So if you're a member of the Appropriations Committee, you do not see this money. And we'll talk about that or ask questions as we go along here. So the South Dakota Bred Racing Fund, found in 42771, is used for this purpose. One-fourth of the money received by the treasurer under this chapter from the license operating horse racing tracks, of which there are two, Pier and Aberdeen, shall be placed in a special revenue fund known as the South Dakota Bred Racing Fund. The fund shall be used by the commission, and that when I say commission, it's the Gaming Commission. And the Gaming Commission's real mission is to work with Deadwood and what they do out there in terms of gaming. They do some regulatory things with the tribal gaming, and then the racing portion of it, the horse races of what we have in South Dakota, are the oversight that they provide. And Mr. Larry Eliason is our executive director. And I brought Larry along here today in case we have any historical or specific questions. He's done a great job there for years. The funds shall be used by the commission to encourage horse racing and raising and breeding of horses in South Dakota. There's obviously some history that goes back, and I think the statutes, if you look at the years, started in about 1930. This shall be used for providing compensation to the South Dakota bred horses and providing funds to all horse tracks licensed in South Dakota. Now, the Special Racing Revolving Fund, also through the offices of State Treasurer, is disbursed each year by the Commission to increase purses or for operations, or upon request, funds may be granted to a political subdivision of the state, although it's unusual. And talking to Larry yesterday, I don't think we've done that ever. But again, that was originally in the statute. I think the key takeaways here are this money is used for the purses and then the operation of the two tracks, Aberdeen and Pier. The revenues here, the South Dakota Bred Racing Fund and Special Revolving Racing Fund share several of the same revenue sources. Simulcast, of which we have simulcast horse racing in South Dakota, and they give us a percentage of their revenues. We have three sites. Totals about $584,000 a year. Makes up the main revenue or funding stream for this. Specific to the Bred Racing Fund is also one-fourth of all money paid by the live tracks goes into this fund. And that totals about $584 a year. Monies received in the Special Racing Fund are then distributed by transferring the first $75,000 received to the fund. All monies received after the $75,000 are divided up between the Bred Racing Fund and the Special Revolving Racing Fund. And I know this gets a little confusing, but we can talk it through. Simulcast sites pay 1.5% into the Special Racing Fund. And again, that 1.5% gets us to that $584,000 figure that we get each year from them. In addition, the advanced deposit wagering pay a tax of about 0.25% into the fund as well. Expenditures, I think it's key to note, and we differentiate in the Gaming Commission between Deadwood, Tribal Gaming, and then the Racing Fund. The Gaming Commission budget, just so you know, and that's not part of this fund we're talking about, our revenues that we get through Deadwood goes to fund our Gaming Commission state budget. And you do see those monies online, and that is part of their annual appropriation. But it is important. No Gaming Commission expenses are paid out of either the South Dakota Bred Racing Fund or Special Revolving Racing Fund. The disbursements are from these funds are to encourage and support horse racing at the two live tracks in Pier and Fort Pier. I think it's interesting to note, and you probably ask yourself, what's the state of horse racing in South Dakota, and where's it been, and where's it going now? And there's probably some philosophical or policy questions that that are going around in your head related to that. I think one of the key things, this was established to encourage the breeding of South Dakota horses years and years ago to help supplement and pay for that. But also to help supplement and pay for the tracks. The Fort Pierre track gets about 73.9% of their revenue each year from this fund. So I think it's fair to say that that coupled with the 69.1% of the revenue at the Aberdeen track that comes from this fund play a large role in the operation of that track, the breeding of horses, the racing of horses, and then to some extent the purse of the jockeys here. So it's important that they get the money from this fund to operate their track, and I don't think that there's any other way you can probably say it. So from a checks and balances, and we can talk through this too, we give the money to the track for a specific reason, to run your track, but then to also pay your purses. We do audit these funds that we give to both of those tracks each year. Mr. Eliason has a staff that goes and makes sure that that money is going to the right places each year, and they're using it accordingly. And then he also spends time at the races during the racing season, of which I think we have, I don't know, 3 to 5 days here in Pierre, and then maybe a like amount in Aberdeen. Larry's up there. He's on the ground. He's making sure the operation runs right and the money goes to where it needs to be. So that's our checks and balances with both of these racing funds. So interesting concept, especially for government and what we're involved in. And I'll close it up there, Mr. Chairman, and take any questions.
Senator Haverly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Secretary, how many funds under your control do you audit specifically?
You know, I don't know if I have the answer to that. Joan Serfling, our finance officer, would this be the only fund that we audit specifically with revenue staff?
I'm sorry.
Yeah, it may be a good way. And Joan made a good point. This is the only fund that goes to outside sources. So with this, our staff does audit this outside. Outside of that, we rely on legislative audit and some of our own checks and balances. Is that where you were going with that one?
When you said that you do the audit, I mean, it's like me and my business doing my audit.
Yeah.
I don't want to do that.
I
mean, when you made the comment, it struck me. I mean, it's sort of like, well, you know what I mean.
Absolutely.
I mean,
you know,
and do anything I've ever been involved with, whether I serve on another commission or whatever, it's an external audit generally that gives you a bigger and broader and better picture of what's happening within the fund. So that's not obviously what happens. This is an internal type thing that you guys do per agency or by your agency?
By our agency, by our employees, to ensure that the money that we're giving to the tracks is spent the way it's supposed to be spent. You know, they're not buying beer with it or things like that, you know, and they're actually giving it to the racers and the horse breeders to promote horse racing and horse breeding in South Dakota. So I track where you're coming from. It's probably not the ideal situation, but it is. And when we talked about this and I came to the department and learned how we did it, I did have some reassurance that we do an audit and make sure there are some checks and balances. But that's the way we do it right now, and we do not have an external group do it.
Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What kind of does the state gain any revenue off of this? I mean, is there anything that?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay, how much revenue does it create? Is it just that? I mean, we're looking at a snapshot picture.
I'll answer that question, but I'll have Larry come up here, and maybe he can give you some depth. Revenue it creates to the state of South Dakota, I'm going to answer none. Revenue that it helps to fund the tracks in Pier and Fort Pier, obviously very important when you look at their overall operating budget and what they do. The revenue that they get through this, I think, is important. I don't think they could operate without it. But from the state perspective, I do not believe that any of this money goes into the state budget or creates revenue for the state of South Dakota.
Well, I vaguely remember, I used to love going to the dog track, not the pony track, but and I've watched states in the region. North Dakota comes to mind.
Yeah.
Who also had a similar setup as to what we have here in South Dakota. Do you know of any other states that are still doing this type of a pony track type setup?
I don't. I'm right into the North Dakota situation and where you're going. Larry, do you want to give some insider history or just how racing is in the U.S. right now related to what we do in South Dakota and maybe where it's going in the future, if you would, please?
My name is Larry Elias, and I'm Executive Secretary of the South Dakota Commission on Gaming. Prior to that, I was Director of the Racing Commission when we had a Racing Commission, and then went to Alabama. I'm not sure that I understood exactly Senator Haverly's question as far as the what we would call in the business the bush tracks or these small meets like Fort Pier and Aberdeen that run for a few weekends at a time. Wyoming and Montana used to have them. They have closed most, if not all, of their tracks. Miles City was running a short season, and I just read in the industry magazine this week that the track in Wyoming, which has been closed, that there is a new corporation that's trying to buy that track to revive it. The number of tracks around the country, even large tracks, have closed. The Birmingham track, where I was the executive director, their horse track closed after one season. They still run greyhounds. The tracks, both horse and greyhound, in Kansas closed a few years ago. The track operators there were supporting legislation that would allow slot machines at the racetracks, which some states have. The track owners said, without the slots, we can't run. The Kansas legislature didn't approve it, the slot machines, so the tracks closed. I was trying to think around the country. Exarban, which was a big track at Omaha, closed several years ago. We had Park Jefferson down in Union County, which ran for a long time along with the Greyhound track down there. Well, those are both closed. There was a track right across the river in South Sioux City, Nebraska, called Atticad. They're now down to, they run one day a year because the Nebraska law allows a facility to simulcast year-round if they run at least one day. And that's the case in some states. In order to either have slot machines or simulcasting, some states require a minimum number of live racing days, and there are some tracks that run just to meet the minimum. In fact, an interesting development on that, there's a track in Kentucky, a track in Florida that is now operating parimutuel wagering on barrel racing, because if they offer parimutuel racing a certain number of days, they can have a poker room. And there's a fight going on in Florida as to whether or not the Florida Division of Parimutuel Wagering should have given them a license. But they've got a license for parimutuel quarter horse racing, so I don't know. Maybe that's a bill we'll see someday here. I don't know.
Representative Trevorville.
Yes, this is for Mr. Gerlach, and excellent report. I really appreciate this. I think I heard you correctly that the horse racing comes under the Gaming Commission.
It does, and the Gaming Commission plays a real key role in this. And what they do is they're actively involved in the operation. And then each year, and in fact, their meeting last week, they look at the appropriation or monies, so to speak, that they want to give to each track. So they track it. They have oversight of that through the Gaming Commission, and then they're the ones that actually approve the monies to give to each of the tracks each year. That's correct.
And I may have missed this. The Gaming Commission budget is funded how?
The Gaming Commission budget, and what I'll say to that is I'll say that's the state government side of this, or the division in which Larry heads. And I think, what do you have, about a dozen employees, Larry, or 14?
I think about 14, 14 full-time, and we have three seasonal part-time at the racetrack.
Right. That is through what we have in statute in terms of fees, and I'll use the term taxes, in Deadwood, on Deadwood Gaming. And then that monies go to, obviously, state government to fund Larry's department, and then also in and around Deadwood, not only to the city, but the school district in your community.
So I heard you correct. Deadwood funds Gaming Commission.
That's correct.
All right. Thank you.
and Mr. Chairman, we really appreciate it, too.
Senator Haverly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Larry, you answered my question before. I mean, I don't see a lot of tracks jumping up out of the ground anymore, and I watched, as I said, I was a dog man myself, and I watched that thing dwindle into nothing, and actually drew a pretty good crowd, but it was no longer of monetary.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman, Senator Ayling. I mean, I have fond memories of the Black Hills Greyhound track, and it was very popular. I mean, for one thing, after dark, you've got the Mount Rushmore lighting ceremony or the dog tracks. I mean, if you were, you know, a tourist staying in a hotel, they had a lot of casual one night customers because of tourists passing through the area.
Got a follow up. Back onto the actual question, and I'm going to ask this. You're with the Gaming Commission, obviously, and do you guys do an external audit of this? This particular fund?
Well, as the secretary explained, we have auditors on staff that primarily do the Deadwood Gaming audits, but we haven't. I mean, I haven't brought in an XYZ accounting firm. Part of it, as the secretary said, the purse money is listed race by race in the program of every race, so it's easy for our people to go through literally race by race, because the amount of the purse and the source of the purse, about 85% of the purses come from these funds. About another 15% are either sponsors or horse owners pay to get in the race. But whatever the source of the fund, whatever source of the purse is printed in the program race by race. As far as the operations, as the secretary said, I'm there most racing days. I mean, the biggest expenses other than purses are for insurance, which you can imagine is, and they always have some pretty, unfortunately, they have some pretty heavy claims when jockeys get hurt. I know they have insurance because I read the insurance policies. I see the insurance forms. And the next biggest thing is probably the totalizator, which is the system that calculates the bets and the payouts. Obviously, I see the tickets being punched and sold. I know they've got a tote equipment. Another big expense is the video system. There are cameras and different locations around the track because we do DVRs of the every race. So in case there's an inquiry, the stewards can play those back. And these are just things that I know they're paying for because I see them.
I'll hold off for a minute.
Yeah. Senator Haverly, with respect to the audit, from our office's perspective, all these funds we're dealing with now were subject to our statewide review of funds. I mean, we would monitor these. I think we call it analytical review, these funds for fluctuations, and they're always subject to our office taking a look at them. We kind of view the Gaming Commission as more of a regulatory process, since they're working with private parties, outside organizations, outside of state government, and they're monitoring, they're regulating those industries, whether that be in Deadwood or these private track owners. Not so much a end-of-the-year external audit, but a more day-to-day regulatory process. I don't know if that helps.
Mr. Chair, I think that helps. That helps. That helps me out. But let me go back to my questioning, and Mr. Gerlach or Secretary Gerlach, there's absolutely no state subsidies towards horse racing.
I will say no. And Larry, if I'm wrong, correct me. And here's the funny. And Senator, let me just say this, Senator. From looking at our budget to what goes, where we get our revenues from, and where they go, there are no state subsidies that go to the tracks to subsidize horse racing. And if I'm wrong, Larry, tell me. But, you know, when I look at budget left, sir, you know, yes, sir, no, sir, three bags full budget stuff, that I do not believe that there is. Larry?
I mean, I guess the only thing I can say is that the revenue sources comes, as the Secretary said, mostly from simulcasting. And there's specific statutes that say that there's a certain percentage that's to be deducted and is paid by the simulcast operators to us on a weekly basis. But those statutes that set out those fees or taxes, if you want to call them that, also set out very specific the purposes for which those funds can be used, which the Secretary read, which was to increase purses or for track operations.
Senator Tiedemann.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Lassen, you did answer my one question that I had, because I was wondering, when you talked about that the money goes to fund the tracks, and that my next question was, what about the equipment? And you kind of answered that along that line. One question I have is, who owns the tracks that they run on?
The tracks at both locations, the license, what we call the association, in both cases is held by nonprofit organizations of local. The board of directors essentially are local businessmen. In Fort Pierre, it's the Verendry Benevolent Association. And in Fort Pierre, in Aberdeen, it is a group of folks called the Northeast Area Horse Racing Incorporated, which is a nonprofit corporation. The facilities themselves are the county fairgrounds in both Stanley County and Brown County.
Follow-up question?
Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now, I know that, Secretary, you mentioned that there's no money that comes into the state. I believe, and I think Representative Dennard probably remembers, that there was a point in time that some of the money was given to the state fair for to assist them in their process. And I don't know how many years back that was, but I remember.
I think about 10?
Maybe even longer, but it was like $75,000 or something like that.
Yeah, we're familiar with what you're referencing.
Sir? Mr. Chairman, I don't remember the exact year. It was somewhere in that area that there was, I believe, a $900,000 transfer to the Department of Agriculture for the state fair, because the state fair had gotten into some financial. I don't remember the exact year, but it was a while ago.
Representative Dryden. Or excuse me.
Okay, thank you. Under the licensing of the operating racetracks, how much is that? What do they pay for a license?
They pay $10 per racing day, and then they pay about 4% of the handle. The handle is total bets. And then the individuals pay fees based on the type of license that ranges from $10 to $50.
One additional question, if I could. Also, it's the purpose is to encourage horse racing and raising and breeding of horses. Is there financial incentives to raise horses?
Yes.
Or how's that done?
Well, Mr. Chairman, how it's done to if the financial incentive to have a South Dakota bred, if I could address that one first. We have two methods of making a South Dakota bred horse more valuable than a horse that's not bred in South Dakota. The first is by having some races that are restricted to South Dakota bred horses, and some of those have comparatively pretty good purses. And the only way you can run a horse in that race is that it has to be South Dakota bred. The other method that we've used for many years is what we call a point system. There's a total of 100 possible points in a race, from 49 for first down to 2 for 8th. And if a South Dakota bred horse runs in a race, they get points depending on where they place. This year, those points were worth about $23 for a quarter horse and about $35 for a thoroughbred, 30 to 35. So running if you had won a race with a South Dakota bred horse, you would have gotten about $1,800 more for a thoroughbred and about $1,100 more for a quarter horse than if that horse had been bred in Wyoming or Texas or someplace. That's how we provide the financial incentive.
Representative Dennert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, Larry, I think you was around. I don't think anybody in this room other than maybe a reporter was around. But, Senator, thanks for jarring my memory on the state fair fighting, because I remember that came up, and it was the way we really kind of bailed the state fair through that year. Mr. Gerlach, you kind of touched my memory a little bit, as I've been here a lot of years when you talked about this started in the 30s, I think. Can you just look down in your sheet and see, was there something in like 95, 6, 7, or 8 in that area that with Governor Janklow on board that we had quite a discussion? And Larry, I think you was part of that. You know, it spurs my memory that there was a big Governor Janklow, and I don't remember all the details to it, but we had quite an update or change or something in this whole issue. And Larry, maybe it's not important to the committee. And before I close, I'll just say, the state doesn't receive any benefits, but any day you run a racetrack in Aberdeen or Fort Pierre, there's concessions there, and the sales tax revenue would definitely come to the state. So anytime you promote something like this, get a crowd out to the fairgrounds in Aberdeen, there's revenue that's being generated. The other thing is, I remember, I haven't attended many races, never in Fort Pierre, in Aberdeen a little bit a few years ago. There's no gate fees, so there's no money. To my knowledge, there's not a gate fee. I think you buy a tip sheet for a buck or two, but there's no gate fee, so the crowd comes in, so the money is all generated through this fund, and or, I don't know, do they pay an entry fee, the horse racers? And you know, so a couple different things that come to my mind, but I'm sure it was in the 90s when Governor Janklow had a... I don't know whether Bernie saddle or what, but if you can help me a little bit,
I'll start on that one, Representative, and then Larry can fill in and talk about it. You know, you take a look at where we were budgetarily in the mid 90s, and we were challenged somewhat like we were the last few years, and I know that the governor back then.
This is a government operations audit committee coming out of recess. Get ready to go ahead. Welcome back, the listeners on the internet. We're going to get started. We have the Secretary of Education here, and we'll move up onto the agenda.
Oh, no, it doesn't. Again, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Tammy Darnell is going to be answering your questions today. I'm going to ask her to come up. I'm going to stay up here with her, but if you would permit me to have her come up, and we hopefully can. Okay, thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Tammy Darnell, Director of Finance with the Department of Education. Thank you for this opportunity to come up here and talk about our funds. I'll just go ahead and jump in and start talking about them in the order they appear in the blue book. I didn't bring any handouts. I thought I'd just go right off the blue book, but please stop me if you have any questions. Excuse me, my ears just popped. Okay, if you start on page 194 of your blue book, that would be our State Institute Fund, and that's one of the funds that you had questions about. And this fund, I think we're all aware of what the Institute Fund does because there's been a lot of discussion about it the last couple of sessions. But what I wanted to point you to is line 13, the total operating revenues, and line 21, the total operating expenditures. If you look in 2009 is when we really had that statute change. 2010 is when we really started to fully implement it within our budget. So if you'll look, these last 2 years, 2010 and 2011, our revenues versus our expenses ongoing, we are spending into the reserves about $60,000 a year on that. So we are spending more to run this program than what our revenues are. In addition, if you look at the line 24, our transfers out, and what this transfers out is if you read the statute for the Institute Fund, part of the teacher certification fee goes into this Institute Fund. Up to 2/3 of the teacher certification fee can go into the Professional Practices Fund to take care of anything that comes up within that Professional Practices. Well, since I've been around, we haven't had to spend that entire 2/3. In fact, you know, it's only been about $60,000-$70,000 a year, depending on what happens with, you know, teacher complaints and stuff like that. So in addition to our expenditures, we transfer out about $60,000 a year that goes into this Professional Practices Fund. So overall, if you look at our revenues and then subtract out our expenditures and what goes into the Professional Practice Funds, we're digging into that reserve to the tune of about $125,000 a year. And I expect that to go on, you know, into the foreseeable future. So chances are, also remember with this fund, this is different than a lot of other funds because as per 1342-4, any changes that have to do with the teacher certification, there has to be a 2-year notification on that. So if I came to you guys today and said I need an increase in the teacher certification fees and everything passed and stuff like that, it would still be 2 years before that increase would actually be implemented. So chances are, and we've been watching this fund, I would say in the next year, 2-3 years, we are going to have to come forward and ask for an increase. The increase, actually, the last one we asked for just went into effect July 1st. So we're going to see how that plays out and how that increase affects it. But like I said, we are digging into the fund. The other thing I want you to be aware of is our programming for the personal record form system, our teacher collection database. Each year we have to make changes due to maybe statutory changes, federal regulations, stuff like that. That comes out of this fund. That's mostly the contractual services. It's about $110,000 a year. We expect a larger expenditure to come out of that probably in the next year or two as we move towards the having to collect data on teacher evaluations. It's coming down the pipeline from the feds. It's coming down everywhere, so we're going to have to collect some more data. And there's changes in what we'll have to collect there. So I expect to see maybe a year or two of higher than normal changes in that system, too.
I have something. Mr. Chairman, too, I'd like to add that if you would look back historically, this fund did have a larger balance. So a few years ago, the statute was very limiting about, I believe that we changed it in 2006. And the statute used to limit us where we could only use it for printed materials and specific uses specific to accreditation. So what we did is we expanded the authority of that fund, so it gave us the ability to use it for other purposes. And if you look at the historical usage of that fund over the last few years, we've really been able to use it more appropriately to offset for salaries for purposes of what the certification fee should be. So it was a matter that we were limited by the usage of it, and now that we've expanded that, have a better use of those revenues as they come in.
With that, I'll stop on this one. That's all I have. Do you have any questions about it?
Representative Dennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just kind of looking at, and Ms. Darnell, you did kind of cover some of it for me, but when you look under your contractual supplies, you talked about contracts and that figure. You know, in if you look at fiscal year 9, how it was, and then jumped in 10 and 11, did the personal services increase a lot because of what reason them same years?
Again, it's just what Dr. Schopp just talked about. It's because the allowable uses of this fund were opened up. Before that, we were very limited.
Thank you. I wasn't paying attention. I was looking at the numbers.
Nope, no
I apologize.
Worries.
Senator Teeterman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, would this fund be available to take care of the counselor, school counselor certification?
Go ahead. I'm going to... Mr. Chairman, this fund, what it does is it takes care of all, these fees are collected from all certifications. So it's across the board from, you know, administrators, teachers, counselors, all those funds come into this one institute fund, and then we use them for those other purposes.
But, okay, I do want to point out, though, the statute again says that the use of the funds are for activities related to school accreditation and teacher training and retention. So statutorily, it'd have to be something related to those items.
Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, as I was reading down, it also said used for the expenses of the Professional Teachers Practices and Standards Commission. And so I was just wondering how rigid it is, or is that something that allows that?
Mr. Chairman, let me just explain. The Professional Practices Commission is very specific to teachers who have had a violation, an ethical violation, and they go before the commission, and then that commission will recommend either licensure revocation or suspension. And so that commission stands separately, and that's, you know, there's no way for us to budget for that commission because we don't know how many cases that we have per year.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions, concerns on this company? Go ahead and move forward.
Okay, thank you. Okay, now I will direct you to page 196, which is what's in the blue book. It's kind of lumped as the DOE Other Fund. What this is really, it's a compilation of, well, this year we have about 24 separate individual subfunds that are actually in this fund. What it is each year it's made up of grants and donations that the department might get. For example, we get about $25,000 from Quest for technology grants that we can do they want us to do for teachers. In the past couple years, 3 years, we've gotten about $50,000 a year from the Great Plains Foundation to go towards the Gear Up program. That money will be ending because the Gear Up that last grant application for Gear Up ended, and we're waiting to hear on the new grant application. We've gotten about $16,000 for the last couple years to run our Scrubs camps. We get about $2,000 a year from the U.S. Senate Youth Program, about $17,000 for the Indian Land Tenure Grant. We've received $47,000 from the Bush Foundation to work with Ty and with the Value Added Research Center in Wisconsin to work on growth models and evaluations of teachers' effectiveness. We've gotten about $80,000 from the Department of Health to work on our coordinated school health efforts. Just various different miscellaneous grants and donations that we place into this fund. An example, we just found out this Monday the Bush Foundation called us and they said they want to give us $200,000 to help with our Common Core training. That money will be deposited in here. So it'll be a sub-fund of its own if you look at our accounting structure, but when you roll it up, it will end up in this fund. Other items that are in this, the E-rate dollars are in here. Right now, we are taking in about $1.8 million a year with E-rate revenue. At the time that the snapshot year end, we had about $1 million last year in E-rate revenue sitting there. A lot of that is just due to timing of when the money comes in from them, but believe me, it's all dedicated and obligated in our technology and school budget. If you recall, about 4 or 5 years ago, the legislature came and took any extra money we might have from E-rate, and they swept that out, and we really are just operating. We're waiting for revenues to come in, as they do from USAC. The other thing that goes in there are some of the miscellaneous fees that we collect, and these are very recent fees that are related to the technical institutes. The M&R fee that was implemented a couple years ago, that money goes into this fund. The technology fee and the project development fee all go into here. And so that explains why you've kind of seen that larger increase, which I guess is one of the things that kind of flagged this fund. Are there any questions?
Thank you.
All right, great. Okay, now I will direct you to page 197, which is the State Library Fund. This one's very easy. It's actually kind of two separate funds. Our Gates Foundation grant that we get, and we never know for sure when we're going to get the Gates Foundation grant, that goes into this fund. At the time of this, that was about $12,000 balance that we had left on that grant. We have not heard yet if we're going to get a renewal of that grant or if that will be done for a while. In addition, we put any miscellaneous gifts and donations that come to the State Library into this fund. Included in that is, if you recall, a couple years ago, we went through and we gutted the State Library, got rid of a lot of the collections, did a lot of remodeling. Well, when we did that, we had a lot of shelving that we ended up surplusing and selling. So the revenue from the sale of that furniture and shelving when we remodeled the library came into this fund. And so that is what that other revenue is. And I was really hoping I could come to you today and say it's gone, but it's not. We just got the invoice a couple days ago, so we've submitted it for payment. What we've used that money for is to buy a digital book scanner for the State Library. And that scanner plus the software we need has cost us about $35,000. So between that and when we're done paying out the Gates Foundation grant, this fund will be pretty much zeroed out unless we get another Gates grant. Any questions?
Any questions or concern? Representative Dennert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No question as far as the fund or the fund balance. I just have a question. In a constituent visit here a couple weeks ago, I had a person concerned about the library. So if he wants to come in and testify, question, it would be during the Department of Education's budget briefing. Would that be the time when I should try to schedule him?
Mr. Chairman, I would also suggest if he wants to just come in and visit with me, that would be...
I think he would like to testify
at the
Appropriations Committee, but that would be the time. So I'll just try to...
Be up to the committee. But yeah.
Okay, I'll just look at the committee date. Thank you. I knew it was a little off base, but I just wanted to find when it would be the appropriate time in the State Library. Thank you.
Any other questions or concerns for the Secretary? Thank you very much for being for us this morning, or this afternoon. Appreciate it. Well, we're running a little ahead. Tim is out right now trying to get the other Department of Revenue and Natural Resources in. I think this would be a good time that we can talk about the committee decision on the upcoming agenda items. Are there anything that we would like to see put on there?
Mr. Chairman, DOT, Mr. Berquist, has got a ruling in an attorney general's opinion, which Tim has shared with me, and I did talk to some LRC staff on that contractual spraying and stuff that we had a concern. And I guess I could do it personally, and I'll do it personally, but if you want a little more update on my reasoning, I would maybe have him come and appear to the whole group, because the attorney general ruled that we don't need any legislation. They don't necessarily have to take... They can take a lower bid from a governmental entity if they both bid. See, what happened is they wouldn't accept a bid from a governmental agency for weed spraying because they said they couldn't if a private individual bid it. The attorney general ruled, you know, that they don't have to do that, and I just would like a little follow-up. I could do it personally, but if the committee feels they want to hear him answer it, that's up to you, Mr. Chairman, and the committee. But otherwise, I'll do it privately. or you could schedule him for me.
I think we need to go ahead and bring him back and let and get the ruling from the Attorney General on it, Secretary of Department of Transportation, on the weed spraying.
And the Attorney General ruling, I'd like him to come in.
Senator, go ahead.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I have one item that has been brought to me by a couple of different legislators, and it has to do with the Medicaid computer system, that the contractual issue that they had a while back. And I brought it up to the Chair of Appropriations as a follow-up because people are asking questions as to whatever happened with that. And I think what's going to happen, and I talked a little bit with Tim on the phone. I did, yeah, on the phone the other day. And I think what's going to happen is we're going to ask the question during appropriations. We're going to let the secretary know that there's going to be some questions that has to do with that. And then hopefully in the first meeting of GOAC, we'll have a follow-up if there was some type of action that they had to take to resolve any issues. We can bring it back up at GOAC in the spring meeting. So if, Tim, if you can just make a note, we'll follow up with I think it's Senator Brown this year, and we'll follow up with him in the middle of session or whenever the committee hearings are. So that's been the only thing. And I would ask as the incoming chair next year that if you have anything that's burning throughout session, a burning desire for the spring meeting, make sure you bring it up and we'll get it on the agenda right away and start down that path again. So thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other things that we need to be looking at? I know that we got a while before the next meeting is going to be whenever Senator Haverly is going to call the next meeting. So we've got some time to put an agenda together also. Tim has informed me that Secretary of Department of Environmental Resources are on his way over, so we'll stand down for till he gets here. We have the Secretary of the Department of Environmental and Natural Resources with us. If you'd like to come to the table, we'll get started. Thank you very much for coming in early. Appreciate it. Sorry about juggling your schedule around for you today.
Not a problem, sir. My name is Steve Perner, Secretary of the Department of Environment and Natural Resources. We want to thank you for taking the opportunity to give us some time to talk about some of our other funds. Our two division directors have put together some short presentations on the four funds that you've asked about. I think the first one off, it will be Dave Templeton. He's the director of our Division of Financial and Technical Assistance, and we'll talk about some of the infrastructure-type funds that provide critical support to our communities to provide water, wastewater, and solid waste facilities for the citizens of our communities. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll turn it over to Mr. Templeton.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name, again, is David Templeton. I work for DNR and PIER. I work for Secretary Perner. As Secretary Perner noted, we did put together a presentation for you on the information you requested. And what I would like to do, with the Chairman's permission, is walk you through the presentation. You asked for four DNR funds, other funds. And my plan today is I will give you a presentation on the first three, and actually the second and third are combined into one presentation because the funds are so similar. Then Tim Tolliser will get up at the end, and he'll do the fourth presentation on the Hazardous Waste Revolving Fund. So with your permission, I'd like to start through the presentation.
Go ahead and get started.
Okay, as you asked the department for information on the four DNR other funds, and they are the Water Environment Fund, the Clean Water State Revolving Fund, the Drinking Water State Revolving Fund, and the Hazardous Waste Revolving Fund. As I mentioned, I'll have a separate presentation for the first one. I'll combine a second and third one, and then we'll have a final presentation on the Hazardous Waste one. If you move on to slide three, the Water Environment Fund is Company 3073 in your blue book, It's we call it the WEEF for short. Nice simple acronym. In my presentation today, I'd like to cover what is the WEEF, why was it created, and what it is used for. If you go to slide 5, the WEEF was established in 1972 by the legislature as a part of an effort to facilitate water resources development in our state. And it's a special capital projects fund in the state treasury. Moving on to slide 6, at that same time, during the 72 legislature, they also established what's called the state water planning process. And that formalized the process of project goes through from the inception of the idea to the engineering, completion of the engineering report into design, and eventually coming before our board for a funding decision. And so these two things have worked very well in the past. If you move on to slide 7, and by the way, Mr. Chairman, I'd be willing to take questions as I proceed, or you can wait to the end, whatever you're...
Very good.
On slide 7, prior to 1993, when a project was looking for state assistance, the department and the project sponsor had to come before the legislature every year, and they had to fight for those limited general funds. And you can, as you know today, there's a lot of interest for the limited general funds. And it just was really an unwieldy process. And so the late Governor Mickelson with the legislature in 1992 and 1993 established and dedicated funding for both solid waste and water projects. Solid waste occurred first in 1992 and dedicated water funding in 1993. And it was structured so that those new revenue streams would go into the WEEF for eventual appropriation by the legislature. If you move on to slide 9, this is a kind of a pictorial or a diagram of what those dedicated revenues are, where they come from, where they go. And this is something that we provide to the Legislative Appropriations Committee every year when we appear before them on a governor's omnibus water bill. But looking at that flow chart, if you look at the upper left-hand circle, the online lottery ticket revenues, this is where the online ticket revenue proceeds, or revenues, to state government, the first net $1.4 million goes to the general fund. And thereafter, everything else that is generated goes into the capital construction fund, which is the square rectangular box in the center. Now, on an average year, we're looking at about $5.5 million as far as that revenue stream. If you skip over to the right, the upper right box called the tank inspection fee, currently there's 2 cents per gallon on bulk fuel sales in the state. The first full penny goes entirely to the ethanol fund to pay for ethanol plant construction. 78.7% of the second penny goes into the capital construction fund, and that's zero you see there. Typical year, you're talking about $6.5 million. The other 21.3% of the second penny, that goes to fund the Petroleum Release Compensation Fund, and that revenue stream is about $1.75 million. So you have those two revenue streams going into capital construction fund, and then you have 3 revenue streams coming out. On the left, you have the ethanol fuel fund. They get an additional portion of the second penny, 25.6%. That equates to about $3 million. The state highway fund on the far right gets 2.6%, about $300,000 on average year. And the capital construction fund transfers into the WEEF is a majority, 71.8% of that deposit. That equates to approximately $8.6 million each year. So you have that revenue stream going in the Water Environment Fund. You also have four more revenue streams that I show going into the Water and Environment Fund box. Starting in the upper left, you have the contractor's excise tax. On those major water projects that the legislature declares as state water resource management system priority projects, and a good example would be Lewis and Clark, on any of those that cost more than $20 million total project cost, the contractor's excise tax is collected and deposited into the Water Environment Fund. Down below that, we have loan repayment and interest. The Board, Water and Natural Resources, makes loans out of the Water Environment Fund. appropriations, and those loan repayments and interest come back into the fund also. Then on the right side, we have a couple solid waste revenue streams. We have the tipping fee. For every ton of municipal solid waste that's landfilled at our 15 regional landfills in the state of South Dakota, there's a $1 per ton surcharge that is collected. Those dollars go into the WEF. That's about $450,000 a year. The last circle down there is a tire fee. That's a tire fee, whereas each year when you register your vehicles, you're paying 25 cents a tire, not to exceed a dollar a vehicle, that is then deposited into the WEF. And that generates about $1.2 million. So all told on an average year, and it varies, we're looking at about $12 million approximately that are deposited into the WEF. They only then get appropriated out through the governor's omnibus bill, which I'll talk about in the next slide. Okay. Yes, sir.
Okay. The tire fee that happens at registration time, not the tire fee that's paid going by the
tire. We'll start over. The one you just talked about, the tire fee, happens at registration where you have a vehicle with four tires and you pay 25 cents a tire. That $1 appropriates into this fund here. We, I believe, pay an additional or a fee when we buy a tire to help defray the cost of getting rid of it at the far end of its life. Does that not come into this fund here as well?
Mr. Chairman? Okay. There's an optional fee when you buy a new tire. If you want the retailer to take that used waste tire off your hands, you typically be charged $2 to $2.50. And the retailer then normally uses that to dispose of the tire. These monies have been used not only for tires, they've been used for recycling activities, disposal activities, but also the statewide cleanup of some large tire piles in the past, under the Spruce Up South Dakota program, as well as several statewide collections of tires that, for one reason or the other, don't end up at the retailer and nobody pays that disposal fee.
So, that fee is strictly for tires?
That fee is strictly for tires and does not affect the water fund, the one that happens at the tire sales?
Correct.
Thank you.
Okay, then moving on to slide 10. The revenues come into the WEF, but yet they're deposited there, but the legislature has to appropriate out those dollars in order for those dollars to be expended. And they do that through the governor's annual omnibus water bill. And approve appropriations for water, wastewater, and solid waste projects out of this bill. This bill typically contains an emergency clause so that when the governor signs it, assuming it's passed in February, our board then schedules a March meeting so that we can try to get as many of those dollars awarded and out on the street for the upcoming construction season. That bill in the last few years has seen very good bipartisan support by the legislature. I think they recognize the value of the bill and the good it's doing. Once those dollars are appropriated out, the Board of Water and Natural Resources is the entity that actually awards those dollars. The staff from the department reviews the applications and acts as a support staff for the board. But as you can see here, the Board of Water and Natural Resources is a seven-member board appointed by the governor. They also serve as a governing board for the Conservancy District, and I'll talk about that a little bit in the second presentation. They then award dollars for the consolidated program, the drinking water and the clean water. No, I'm sorry. They do not award them for the clean water and the drinking water state revolving fund programs, and I'll talk a little bit more about that also in the second presentation. They also award project awards for solid waste projects and those major water projects that are designated by the legislature as a SWARMS project. And the board meets about five times a year. Moving on to slide 12. Each year, each fall, the board holds a public hearing to take testimony from project sponsors and the public, if they so desire, on recommendations of what should be in the upcoming governor's omnibus water bill. And the board held their hearing this past November 10th. And I'm glad to say that a report that the 2012 governor's omnibus water bill should be consistent with the board's recommendations. The Board of Water and Natural Resources also prepares an annual report slash state water plan each year. And this is an example of what you're going to see. It's passed out to the legislature each first week of each session. This summarizes the past year's activities. I'm glad to report that in 2011, calendar year 2011, the board awarded $109 million in grants and loans. So it was a good year, good activity. And this is also put on our website for general public's use. Moving on to slide 14, dedicated water development and solid waste funding has been extremely beneficial to South Dakota, not only for quality of life, but for economic development. If you got a business coming in, more than likely they're going to need a good, dependable source of water. They're going to need adequate wastewater treatment facilities, solid waste to a lesser extent, but if they produce solid waste, they need a place to take it. If you look at the pie chart on slide 15, that summarizes the dedicated water funding portion since 1993, almost $152 million. If you look at the pie chart, about 56, a little more than 56% has gone to regional water systems. That they have proved extremely beneficial to the state. If you go to slide 16, I have listed examples of some of those awards, the cumulative awards, Lewis and Clark obviously being the big one. Southern Black Hills is still under construction, and Perkins County, I think I'll talk about it a little bit later, has identified some more work that needs to be done also. Moving down to slide 17, however, the work isn't done. Southern Black Hills system, the state, the legislature has established a $12 million state cost share commitment for that project. There's still $7.8 million that you need to appropriate at some time out of the WEF in order to complete the state cost share for that project. Belfouche Irrigation Project, I think you'll see that in the governor's omnibus bill. That's a new project that we're going to request the legislature to do several things. Place it on that SWARMS list as a preferred priority project, establish a state cost share commitment of $5 million, and make the first appropriation towards that state cost share commitment. And that's for some siphon upgrades, a control house, and some sediment removal that's badly needed on that project. Even though the rural water systems or regional water systems have been very successful, they have been so successful that they're never done. They continue to expand and come to us and to the board for funding assistance. If you look at when you get the state water plan, that's the other portion of this. This is projects that are going through that state water planning process in order to be in a position to come before the board for funding. There's $151 million of requested funding needs or funding assistance on various projects. And the total project needs for those of that is $196 million. Perkins County, rural water system, as I mentioned earlier, they've identified an $8 million water treatment plant needs. They're short of water during dry spells, and they're limited to the amount of water they get from North Dakota Southwest Pipeline. And so they identified either a water treatment plant or maybe a groundwater source, about $8 million, but they haven't quite figured out and put together a funding package yet for that. And the other one I list with a question mark is the Tri-County Water Association. It's otherwise known as the Minnewaste System. Large rural water system in Dewey County, Searce Faith, the Cheyenne River Indian Reservation. There's about $200-300 million worth of needs out there. That project has not yet come and requested any kind of a SWARMS designation or a state cost share commitment, but nevertheless, it's definitely a need out there for those people. Moving on to slide 18, this is a pie chart summarizing the solid waste awards, and that again was a tire fee and the landfill disposal fee. Almost $36 million since 1992. And you notice the breakdown there of where the dollars went. Some of the activities we funded with these dollars I've listed on slide 19. closure of small town dumps. That was a big activity back in the early 1990s. The federal government came out with the new Subtitle D rules, the open burning, open small town dumps that we used to all have back then that were no longer allowable. And we ended up closing, I think it was around 170 of those, and we went to 15 regional landfills. In place of small-town dumps, we ended up constructing or cost-sharing quite a few restricted-use facilities. That's at the small towns. They can still take maybe some yard waste, tree branches, waste concrete, things like that. Keeps the cost down of having to transport that kind of stuff to regional landfills. We've done a lot of tire collections, and we've I think we're in a pretty good position regarding recycling. We have a lot of activities, a lot of operations going in different towns. We funded both publicly owned as well as privately owned recycling operations. So all total, if you add those two pie charts together, we're looking at about $187 million out of those two dedicated funding sources, being solid waste and the water, dedicated water. And on slide 20, that'll tell you that I'm done with my presentation, and I'll attempt to take questions. I do have a couple staff members here that came in, I think, after Secretary Perner's introduction. Jim Feeney in the back is administrator of the Water Resources Assistance Program. His program has all of our funding programs. And Rob Green, sitting back here, he's our finance officer.
Are there any questions, concerns? Senator.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I think that the program in South Dakota has been extremely successful in helping getting, 36 rural water systems across the state, roughly. I mean, they're in different phases. My question focuses on that the first ones went in about 1972, and then you have some that between 1972 and 1980. And when they were going in, the engineer said that, you know, the pipe and everything, you've got about a 50-year life expectancy. With what's happening with the federal government and some of the funds not flowing in for rural water system projects, how is the state going to position itself to ensure that we don't allow these tremendous infrastructures go under? I mean, do we have the flexibility within our bonding? Most of the rural water systems can't tax. They can't do things like municipalities. So,
I don't think we've seen a lot of formal planning, perhaps, or at least that I'm aware of, by those rural water systems. I know they're continually, though, upgrading their systems, and I think some of that includes either running parallel lines. I'm not aware of a lot of lines that have gone bad to where they've had to go back in. I'm sure there's some. But that's definitely a challenge and something to be thinking about down the road. And I do know a lot of them have some reserve funds established. We've required that their monthly cost be raised $5 in the last year or so to be able to access our funding. And that's about all I can, I guess, report on that item.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much for a nice presentation.
Okay, then moving on the if you turn about another page, again, Mr. Chairman, my name is Dave Templeton with DNR. I'll talk now about the Clean Water and Drinking Water State Revolving Funds. We call these SRF for short. Again, they're very similar, so I combined it in one presentation. What I hope to do on slide 22 is tell you a little bit about what they are, why they were created, and what they're used for. On slide 23... the SRF programs, the first one, they started in about 1988. We made a first loan in 1989. The clean water is for wastewater and stormwater projects. And in the 70s and in the 80s, there was a program, a federal program through EPA called the EPA Construction Grants Program. And that built a lot of the wastewater infrastructure, especially on the treatment side that we see today. That program pumped in about $184 million into the state. Basically for municipal wastewater treatment plant upgrades. That program was phased out by Congress, and they then phased in a loan program called the Clean Water Program in 1989. I think it was fairly very successful, and they then followed suit with the Drinking Water Program about 9 years later. We made it, I think it was about 1997, we made our first water loan in 1998. and what the programs are. They're low interest, and by low interest, I show there below market rate loan programs for drinking water, stormwater, wastewater. Federal regulations require that all the dollars that go into the program, and once they're loaned out and repaid, they have to stay in the program and revolve in perpetuity. How is it funded? I show that on slide 24, the EPA capitalization grant. There's an annual EPA capitalization grant for both programs. We call these CAP grants for short. They vary by program, or whether it's clean water, drinking water, and by year. But for instance, I show you the federal fiscal year 2011 amounts there on that slide. Drinking water is typically a little bit higher. They have ramped up in the last couple of years now with the federal deficit issues. They're starting to ramp back down, so we don't know what yet the 2012 level might actually be. But when we get these EPA capitalization grants, we have to provide, we being the Conservancy District or the state, has to provide $1 match for every $5 we get by way of a CAP grant. And the Conservancy District does that primarily by issuing tax-exempt bonds. If you move on to slide 24, there again, in the earlier presentation, I mentioned the Board of Water and Natural Resources. It has a dual capacity. It also acts as a South Dakota Conservancy District, and they have the legal wherewithal to do the bonding. The Board of Water and Natural Resources does not. And so they issue then bonds for that state match. We've never had to turn a loan request down due to fact that we don't have enough money. If we end up in that position, we'll typically go back out and issue what's called leverage bonds, and they're bonds above and beyond what's required for the state match. And you'll see here that our Conservancy District has gone out multiple times and issued a total of about $160 million of leverage bonds. We're also looking at a potential 2012 leverage bond for the clean water side. We have enough dollars on the drinking water, but we think we're going to be short on the clean water. We're still in the process of determining what that bond amount might be. Moving on to slide 27, the Conservancy District's bond issues are all AAA rated. We don't have to provide insurance or whatever, and that reflects, obviously, the strong financial strength of both programs. SDCL 46A-1-42 makes it very clear that these bond issues are not debt of the state. They're debt of the Conservancy District, and it makes that very clear. And so we, through our bond council and our SRF team that I'll talk about in a little bit, there's a master trust indenture that governs the bond issues and how the money is spent and who we loan it to and things like that. Moving on to slide 29, this is what I call the SRF team. We employ a trustee to do the trustee work, loan servicer, paying agent, and that's a First National Bank in Sioux Falls. We employ a Red Book bond counsel, Perkins Cooey, and that gentleman, very, very knowledgeable. His name's Bruce Bonjour. We also employ a financial advisor, Public Financial Management. And they help us run a lot of the complex calculations when we size bond issues and repayment capabilities and work with the rating agencies on our ratings. And then when we issue tax-exempt revenue bonds, we commonly employ an investment banker to do the sales and marketing and some of that, although I think we have gone out for two competitive sales on shorter-term type notes. I mentioned on one of the earlier slides, below market interest rates on slide 30, kind of lists our current rates. If you go to 1 to 10 years, and there's some variations here, but this is generalized, what the generalized interest rates are. You're looking at 2.25. If you go up to 20, you're looking at 3. And then on the clean water side, if you have a project that has a usable life of up to 30 years, our board can give you a 30-year loan. On the drinking water side, there's another twist there. If you're a disadvantaged community, and we define disadvantage as below the medium household income, you can get varying rates. If you're as low as below 60% of the medium household income, we can give you, our board can give you a 0% loan. So a medium household income is used to define disadvantage on the clean water side. Moving on to slide 31. I mentioned when the two programs began. Since those beginning of those two programs, our board has issued a combined 485 loans to the tune of a little more than $788 million. On the next two slides, I have a map of the state of South Dakota. Every one of these little dots represents a loan recipient under one of these two programs. The first map is clean water. Second is drinking water. I turn your attention to that little box we pulled out in the bottom of the first map on slide 32. I just want to show you that if you look closely, you can see Sioux Falls there at the very bottom. It's got a parentheses and a 33. That means that they've been awarded 33 clean water SRF loans since the program began. If you look on the drinking water side, you'll see 11. So Sioux Falls has been a big, has really accessed our program and I think found it to be beneficial. Moving on to slide 34, I called it a low interest loan program. EPA and the Stimulus Act threw in a little bit of a wrinkle into that. With the receipt of the 2009 stimulus monies, and we, the department received about $38.5 million for SRF funding that came in through these two existing programs. They required that at least 50% of those monies have to be awarded as additional subsidy. And there was a couple options available to us. Our board ended up choosing the option called principal forgiveness. It was a little bit less paperwork. And what that means, if we would give a loan to Miller for $1 million and the board had a 10% principal forgiveness component, Miller only had to pay back $900,000. That 10% or $100,000 was basically a grant and forgiven. We ended up funding about 69 projects with the stimulus dollars, and the overall additional subsidy or principal forgiveness was about 83%. So the majority of those dollars went to a lot of projects that probably wouldn't have been built without that principal forgiveness component. That has carried forward into the 2010-2011 CAP grants, varying degrees depending on which program we're talking about. Some of them we can go up to 100% of the CAP grant as principal forgiveness. Others were capped at 20 and 30%. So that will probably stay with us for the time being. It's beneficial to us. It helps complement the consolidated program where we're really short of money. At any one time, there's SRF funds that are available for investment. And the investments, though, you know, I mean, have to be somewhat liquid in that we've got repayments to make and cash flow requirements and things like that. And so liquidity is definitely a consideration for a program investment. And prior to 2008, the investment option that proved to be the most attractive was what was called GICs, or Guaranteed Investment Contracts. And they were, you know, accessed through a competitive bid process. And they worked really well. When the market collapsed in 2008 and stuff, new GICs became not viable any longer. There just wasn't enough interested AAA-rated GICs providers, and their interest rates were not attractive. And so we had to look for a different mechanism or investment option at that point with some of those dollars. Now, the district does have a written investment policy, and I'll just give you kind of the three legs of that. They want to maximize the security of the principal. They don't want to lose principal. And they do that by seeking highly rated options and diversifying. They want to have sufficient liquidity to make those payments, cash flow requirements. And they're looking for a competitive rate of return. Moving on to slide 36. In 2010, our SRF financial advisor and bond counsel worked with the two rating agencies, the Standard & Poor's and Moody's, to explore the option of investing in South Dakota Investment Council's cash flow fund. The problem was the cash flow fund is not rated by the rating agencies. And therefore, at the end of the day, the board adopted a investment policy that capped investment in the cash flow fund at 20%. And this, by the way, is company 3075 in your blue book. And that has worked well. I think in the last half, it's the first investment was in early 2011. I think cash flow fund paid about $440,000 interest in the last half of state fiscal year 11. In the next slide, slide 37, I kind of want to summarize some of the oversight we have on these two programs. First one is we have annual audits by the legislature, in fact, by the legislative audit, and in fact, we have two people over there as we speak starting the state fiscal year 2011 audit. We haven't had any written findings on our audit, so we are pleased to report that. We also have periodic oversight visits by EPA personnel out of Denver. They come in and they pull some random files, check our paperwork, our documentation. They go out in the field and accompany our people when we do field inspections on the project. They check some of the federal requirements, such as Davis-Bacon, and with the ARRA monies, there was some Buy American provisions that they wanted to check on. We have annual presentations to the Legislative Bond Review Committee, and Mr. Feeney gave that presentation to that committee yesterday. And we present kind of a fairly thick report to that committee, recapping our activities. I'm happy to report they accepted our report for the Bond Review Committee. We have annual fiscal year reports of each fund to EPA, and here's an example of Federal Fiscal Year 11, Clean Water and State Water, and Clean Water and Drinking Water. And we have to post those on our website, submit them to EPA. And then we have that Legislative Oversight Committee there was some discussion on at the beginning of the committee meeting. Senator Tom Hansen, Senator Jim Hunstad, Representative Betty Olson, and Representative Frank Klocek, and they get the full board packet, as well as several of those people come to the meeting on a regular basis. And with that, Mr. Chairman, that concludes my presentation on the state revolving funds, and I'd stand by for any questions.
Do we have any questions or concerns? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very good.
Well, I did.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I appreciate all the history and the data and everything, but I guess if you could walk us through the actual numbers in the blue book, explain why there were either sudden increases or decreases or if there was a jump. And if you want me to, I can kind of go through it all, but I'd prefer not to yet. But
with the chairman's permission, I would at this time like to call Mr. Green and potentially Mr. Feeney up here to they're kind of the experts in that area.
Yeah, my name's Rob Green, finance officer with the ENR. Just so I know what we're talking about here, we're talking about in the blue book, mm-hmm. the statements that are in here, is that we're after? Well, the cash will go up and down based on when we get bond issues in. So, like in 2010, for instance, we had a bond anticipation note.
Mr. Chair, can we start with, let's go to one fund and specifically address each fund individually. If the first one on our list is Water and Environment Fund, let's go to the Water and Environment Fund, and we need a page number on that, which it appears to be 241. Okay.
Okay. Let's see. The cash is going to go up and down based on when the payments for various projects are going to occur. The like Lewis and Clark, for example, they have a huge payout. We give out our loans, and once they ask for reimbursement, is how we give out our funds. And if they ask for reimbursement, they can ask for a very large reimbursement, and our cash balance is going to go down. That's the big thing on how that cash comes in and out of the Water and Environment Fund. The revenue coming in is fairly consistent every year. It's basically, for the most part, you are going to see, if we go down, let's go down to taxes, for example, here. And That one, that line is going to be really, it's going to look really odd because Department of Revenue had some problems in dispersing out the contractor's excise tax. We discovered that they weren't giving us, getting us all our funding in 2010. We discovered that in 2009 that our numbers were very small. And those dollars don't come to us directly. They go through the Department of Revenue, and then we see them later on. And so we don't see those numbers until later. We realize that in 2010, looking back, that those numbers were just too small, so we asked the Department of Revenue to look into it. And they discovered that they weren't providing us with enough money for our contractor's excise tax. And because of that, then we had a larger amount come in 2010. So that's the reason for the large discrepancy in when you're looking at taxes. And you look at the use of money and property line. No, that's the license, permits, and fees. I'm starting my glasses. That's the solid waste line. Those revenues are pretty consistent year after year. The use of money and properties are interest.
Question.
That money is for the most part, fairly consistent. So outside of the, you know, the contractor's excise tax, I believe our revenue streams are pretty consistent. Now, the payouts, again, like I said, those are going to go up and down based on a lot of it, based on when we're, the recipients ask for reimbursement. Also, on the grants and subsidies line, that went up.
Which line?
Line 25. You know why it went up, Jim, in 2011 for the water environment fund? Is there any big main reason for payouts?
In what year?
2011.
It's two things. Lewis and Clark.
Could you please identify yourself for the internet? Thank you.
Oh, hopefully I won't be here too that long. Jim Feeney, I'm an administrator with DENR. I guess we saw two things in 11. Lewis and Clark had two big draws. Again, the previous year, 2009 and 10, they were dealing with ERA money, significant amount of money. It took them a while to get their main treatment plant, the Phase 1 and Phase 2 bids, and so they weren't drawing the state funds concurrently, and it just got to a point where they were able to draw a couple of years of funding. Again, as special appropriations, these are available for 4 years, and it sort of is a good thing in the case with these major projects because, again, they need to know the funding that's in hand, get the engineering done, and bid the projects and so forth. The other project that did a significant draw in the last quarter of 11 was the Sioux Falls flood control. It had a big, its final appropriation was $3,310,000. And as Mr. Green said, we do everything on a cost reimbursement basis, and that is dictated by how fast the projects are done. This is a Corps of Engineers project, and you play by the Corps rules, and in that case, the non-federal funds had to be deposited up front in a Corps account before they bid the project. So that one was a full $3.3 million was paid out and deposited in the Corps of Engineers construction account.
Mr. Chair, I have a follow-up.
Follow-up, go ahead.
I want to go back to the taxes line, and I guess I'm a little concerned that it took us 2 or 3 years to figure out that we were missing money. What kind of procedures or policies are in place to ensure that this miscommunication doesn't happen again and that you guys get your money and revenue sending you your money? I mean, what can we do to ensure that this doesn't happen again? Because that's a huge communication breakdown, in my opinion.
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Since the inception in 93, we had provided the information to Department of Revenue when contracts were awarded for these major projects, again, on the SWARMS list, more than $20 million authorized cost. And quite frankly, I guess we sat back and figured Revenue knew how to do their job, collect the contractor's excise tax. And it was really just in that 2008-09 frame when you had the significant Lewis and Clark expenditures and some staff changes at the Department of Revenue, and again, the numbers just didn't look right. What we have done since then is we've done a better job, I guess, from our side of
besides informing them of the information when those contracts are awarded, that is, as we are copied with pay requests, in a lot of these cases, it's Bureau of Reclamation money being paid, so we're not involved in the payment. But most of these major projects do copy us on those draws monthly, and we've been providing that information to the personnel who are currently handling it at Revenue. And again, we're attempting to do a better job by providing them with all the information we have as far as who the contractors are on these projects and when they're making their draws.
Follow up.
Go ahead.
So are we all caught up now? The taxes are all collected then remitted to the proper places for you guys? I mean, you're made whole even though they missed a couple years.
We believe we are. I guess we're trusting.
What kind of controls are in place to ensure that you're getting what you're getting? I guess I need to ensure that you maybe have a report out there that lists what you're getting or receiving, or Revenue has a report and they're checking off the list. I mean, seems kind of willy-nilly here, and I know that's not politically correct word here, but as an accountant, I'm a little concerned that we're not communicating, there's not a list, there's no checklist. I'm a little concerned.
Go ahead, sir.
Senator Peters, all I can say is to the extent that we provide the information to Revenue, we're hoping that their internal processes, their internal controls are working better, and we're getting the funds from those projects.
Any other questions?
Well,
oh, wait, I'll give Senator Peters some more time here to think.
Mr. Chair, let's move to clean water. If nobody has questions on water and environment, let's go to the next one on the list, the Clean Water State Revolving Fund. I'm looking for the page.
Last chance. Any questions?
Where is clean
water? Okay. We're going to move to the Clean Water State Revolving Fund. That's page 251 for anybody that's... Senator Tiedemann.
Well, if you need a question to, you know, fill in the blanks, I'll abide. So how many rural water system or water projects have been above the $20 million? I mean, the Lewis and Clark was huge compared to what South Lincoln or Lincoln County rural water projects. And so when because you said that kicks in when it's over $20 million, right?
Correct. Mr. Chairman, Miniwichoni, and on that, the non-tribal component to West River Lyman Jones was primarily because of compacts. The tribal portions are the contractor's excise tax is usually remitted to the tribes. Mid-Dakota, Perkins, Sioux Falls Flood Control, and Southern Black Hills would probably be the last one. So, yes, many of the others that we deal with are not that. And they have to be on that swarms list.
Just as a point, make sure you do sign in at the end for our potential door prize that we may have that may bring you back for a visitation to GOAC. Go ahead, Senator Peters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm going through page 251 now on the Clean Water State Revolving Fund, and it looks like we've got some issues with a couple of different funds going on here as far as funds are not available or on the state accounting system on a couple of these funds. Why aren't they timely loaded down to the accounting system?
The statements are the previous page. That's where the mm-hmm. statements are. And the accounting system wise, no, those funds are not on the accounting system. They go through First National Bank through our trustee.
Mr. Chair, we don't have any funds that aren't on the state accounting system. Why is this one unique? I thought we got all information, whether it was run through a different bank or not. If it's an outside checking account, it was my understanding they still loaded it either a monthly basis or a quarterly basis. I've never heard that this is being done and not. Loaded until an audit is done. Is this new?
No.
Bob Christensen with Legislative Audit. No, there's still a couple funds. These bonding programs that are run through trustees, some of the authorities like the Finance Authority, the Federal Unemployment Insurance Fund, which is administered in Aberdeen. That's also not on the accounting system. The information is available once they post their financial statements, but it wouldn't be available by the time they close the accounting system out.
How often do we update? I mean, what's the timing on getting this updated? I mean, it seems to me that it's a public-run entity. We need to have information a little bit sooner than when they get the audit done.
For instance, the unemployment insurance fund, it's audited by a CPA firm and that, and that report's going to be coming out here shortly. So the accounting system closes, middle of July. Some of that information. And the information on these bonding authorities is full accrual. So, again, that the state's accounting system being cash accrual can close fairly quickly because, I mean, you cut off when you write the checks and when the money's deposited. So that causes, I think, some of the problems on where a local bank account for Board of Accountancy or something like that, yeah, they can load their balances on a timely basis.
Okay.
These are full accrual statements we're talking about here, so it's the system closes before they could get the information available to load on there, unless you want some type of just cash basis type system.
I don't remember having this conversation when we started this process so many years ago.
Well, I think we've talked about before the trustee handling these two Diener funds before, and because up until 2011, there never was any of the bond proceeds that ever went into the fund until you met with your bond counsel, and now you've got 20% into the cash flow fund and that. So prior to that, everything was run through the trustee bank, the First National Bank, and that's the unemployment insurance fund. Everything's run through the U.S. Treasury.
Okay. All right.
Any other questions? Concerns? Are we done? Thank you very much. Appreciate you coming forward today.
Chairman?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tim Tolish. I'm the Director of Division of Environmental Services within DENR. And I'm here to talk today about the last fund on your list, the Hazardous Waste Revolving Fund. I think it's company 3075 in the state accounting system. Like Dave mentioned, I'm going to talk mainly about what the fund is, why it was created, and what it was used for. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about a current activity regarding the fund that has influenced some of the balances in that fund and the use of it, just to give you an update on those issues. My slides start at number 39 and go on from there at the end of your handout. The Hazardous Waste Revolving Fund was created in 1990 by the legislature. It's codified in 34A1124. The primary purpose of that fund is to cover the expenses related to the permitting inspections of hazardous waste facilities. The fund is comprised primarily of fees that are collected from those facilities that are permitted under that program, and according to that statute, the fund constitutes a continuing appropriation. There are two types of fees that go into that fund. The first one is a permit fee established in 34A1112.1. Under that statute, there's an initial permit application fee of $50,000 that's due upon submittal of an application for a permit. And then there's a $25,000 amendment or a renewal fee that's due upon submittal of that amendment or renewal application. There's also a inspection and monitoring fee of $25,000 each year That's due for those facilities that dispose of more than 500 tons per year of hazardous waste and operate a disposal facility. That fee is due each year at the same date as their permit issuance. I'm going to talk a little bit later on about a facility in South Dakota that's trying to get a permit under this program. That particular facility has significantly less than 500 tons per year of waste that they need to dispose of, so that particular fee is not applicable in the case that I'll be talking about here in a minute. The permitting history, as far as in this program, until 2010, there was not a hazardous waste disposal facility either proposed, built, or permitted in South Dakota. So therefore, the Hazardous Waste Revolving Fund has sat there since 1990 and has not had any funds deposited into it, nor has DNR used that fund for any particular purpose. That has recently changed. And just give you a little background. Since the late 1980s, a company called Technical Ordnance, located in the town of Clear Lake, has manufactured detonating devices for the military. The hazardous waste generated at that facility consists primarily of different types of powders and different types of explosive materials. And in accordance with our regulations, they're considered a large quantity generator of hazardous waste. Until just recently, those waste generated at the plant could be rendered stable, and they were transported off-site to another facility outside of South Dakota in South Carolina. In 2010, the company was purchased by another company called Chemring Energetics. That company, after purchasing the facility, increased production at the plant as well as increased production of the amount of hazardous waste that were generated and the types of waste that were generated. And now some of the waste that they do produce cannot be rendered stable for off-site transport. While the company has made a lot of progress on making sure that there's automated procedures for worker safety at the plant, there still remains an issue with how they could render their waste stable. As a result of that, they no longer can transport the hazardous waste outside of South Dakota in a safe manner. And they needed to find a way to dispose of those sites or those wastes on site. In October 2010, as a result of an enforcement action from DENR, Chemring submitted an application to us for what's called an emergency hazardous waste disposal permit. In that program, we can issue that emergency permit to allow the company to proceed with a short-term disposal plan for its waste. With that application, Chemring submitted a $50,000 application fee as required under the statute and was deposited in the fund. We processed that application as required by state requirements and issued the company an emergency permit which allowed them to proceed with their short-term disposal plan. In March 2011, then, the company submitted a second application for its long-term plan and along with that submitted a second $50,000 application fee. Since the second application was submitted, though, Chemring has continued to revise its application and change it based on what they feel is necessary to handle those types of waste at their facility. As a result of a recent meeting with them, the company is now committed to finalizing that application by April 2012. So far to date, DNR has not yet expanded any of the fees that we've collected from this facility, primarily because Chemring has not submitted a complete application yet for its long-term disposal plans, and we're not sure yet what they intend to do for long-term. Our initial reviews of the application thus far and our processing of the emergency hazardous waste application was completed using our federal hazardous waste grant, and we mainly did that to expedite the process to make sure that we got that emergency permit in place as soon as possible, so the facility could proceed with its long-term plan. At the point their current application is deemed complete, we expect to begin using the fund, the fees from the fund, to pay for staff time to review and process that permit application and to do any necessary inspections of the facility as required by either state or federal law. In summary, Mr. Chairman, there's only been two deposits into this fund since its inception in 1991, and on October 2010 and one on March 2011, both of those which have been $50,000. We have not had any expenditures from the fund yet because the long-term application from Chemring is not yet complete. We expect to begin using that money to review and process the complete application once it's submitted in April 2012 as promised by the company and to do the required inspections. At this time, we do not expect any other facilities in South Dakota to submit any type of other permit application for a federal or for a hazardous waste disposal permit. With that, Mr. Chairman, I also have Vonnie Calamine with me. She's the administrator of our waste management program. In case you have any specific questions about the details of our waste management program, with that, I will try to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions, concerns? Very good. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Well, I believe that was the last item on our agenda. As everyone knows, this is a joint commission between the Senate and the House. My term as chairman is now up. I appreciate all your help. I appreciate Tim and everything your staff has done for me to get us through this year. And I'm now I'm going to turn the gavel over to Senator Haverly.
Well, I don't think anything's going to change. So, do we have any other agenda items that we have to go through? Is there anything else to come before the committee at this time? If not, I will. And all in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Don't hear any nays. We are adjourned.